hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
It's time for Conscious Parenting with Sandra Jones Keller and family. Welcome back. Let's get you to reintroduce yourself, your show, and what's up for today.
Thank you so much. Hello and happy holidays. My name is Sandra Jones Keller, and this is the Conscious Parenting Show, and I'm joined today by my husband. My husband's joining me today.
I'm on. I'm here. Hello.
It's been a minute. We've been enjoying the holidays. So we're broadcasting live on News for the Soul Radio and on my YouTube channel at Sandra Jones Keller. So for those of you who would like to see us live, head over to my YouTube channel. So maybe you have questions about discipline or bedtime or being an empty nester. Whatever is on your mind, we'll do our very best to answer it from a conscious parenting perspective. And we've been quite surprised by the number of people who have responded to questions about being empty nesters and who are struggling. So if you're one of those, feel free to call in. And I'm really excited about today's topic. And
how do they ask questions?
They can call in to 646-595-4274 or email your questions to onTheAir@telus.net.
Emailing works better.
Emailing or calling. we don't care. Just reach out. So I have a kind of interesting topic today, and what prompted me to talk about this is I saw a post on Facebook. Wow, I'm messing up my words. Anyway, so the topic for today is teenage rebellion a natural cycle in the parent-child relationship? Woohoo! So think about it and call in with your thoughts on that. And so I actually did a poll on my page asking, are your teenagers cool? Having problems help me. And I was surprised to find that a lot of people are really enjoying their teenagers. So it's not necessarily a natural cycle, but we'll talk more about that. And so what is teenage rebellion and what causes it? So I did a little bit of research on medicine.net. And according to them, rebellion refers to the expression of defiant behavior and disregard for existing rules. Teenage rebellion can be a normal part of growth and development. Now, we've heard a lot about, you know, the teenage brain and all of that stuff. And so, Thomas, you were a teenager.
I was, yes.
And so did you go through a rebellious phase?
No, I did not. I started out rebellious from birth and continued rebellious into adulthood. And I don't know that, well, teenagers were probably more rebellious than any others,
okay.
But yes.
But yeah. So why do you think you were rebellious?
I tell you why I was rebellious. I grew up in a family that, I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, in a family that very much believed in spare the rod, spoil the child, which is just a saying for it's okay to physically
beat you,
spank you. And I received quite a few of those, and I think it just really didn't change my behavior. I became better at hiding it,
I think.
But what it did, it made me more and more angry internally because, well, just imagine, you're getting beaten.
No.
What?
I understand. I was spanked as a child. I had to go out. We had a rose bush on the side of the house. So I had to go out.
A rose bush.
So I had to go out and pick my own switch. And so I learned that I had to pick the right one because if it was too thin, then my mom would go out. And if it was too thick, it would hurt. So I'd go out and pick the right one, and I'd take the thorns off. You know.
Yeah, I hope so.
I would take the thorns off. But, yeah, it was, you know, very traumatic. And as, you know, like you said, it really just had me get better at hiding behaviors that might incur punishment.
And talking and sharing less with your parents or whoever was dishing out the punishment.
Exactly.
You know, my mother would tell my dad it was time to dish out the punishment. So, you know, I kind of blamed it on her because she was always ratting on me.
Nothing to do with your behavior, though, right?
Oh, everything to do with my behavior. But,
okay.
You know, what can I say?
All right. So according to medicine.net, so let's talk more about what it is and the causes of it.
Okay. Rebellion. It's part of their brain development. The prefrontal cortex is a part of the human brain that controls decision-making, social behavior, and personality expression. During the teen years, the function of this part of the brain gets into practice, which results in testing boundaries, arguing, testing, and finally being able to understand the decision-making process.
Okay, and so according to medicine.net, still fighting for independence. We're talking about teenage rebellion and why it happens. Fighting for independence. Another cause of teenage rebellion is a struggle to gain independence. During adolescent years, children start craving more freedom from their parents. Sometimes parents may confuse the need for space for rebellion, and the reactions may lead to teenage rebellion, the exact opposite of what they want.
Right.
What else? What else causes it?
Well, there's a need for control. Teenagers want to have a considerable say in their lives and take authority over their actions. When parents force decisions, teenagers tend to lash out and defy their parents.
And also there's the struggle for acceptance. Teenagers are heavily influenced by peers. They want to fit in and may try to imitate the lifestyles of their friends. The pressure of living a lifestyle they admire may lead to rebellion as they stop listening to their parents. They face the pressure of doing what everyone else is doing and may even risk losing their individuality. They may forget their interests as they try to fit in to someone else's lifestyle. Talking about teenage rebellion?
It's a whole heap of stuff.
It's a whole heap of stuff, yeah.
How about seeking attention? Teenagers love to get and may go to great lengths to gain attention.
Overwearing parents, communicating your worries to your teens all the time may cause them to pick up a habit of ignoring you when you are speaking to them.
And finally, the hormonal changes. Teenagers go through extensive physical changes during adolescence. It may result in decision-making and impulsive behavior.
Okay, so this was according to medicine.net, some of the causes. And so now let's talk about rebellious behavior. So self-defeating and destructive behaviors, neglecting schoolwork or over a long period of time, drinking alcohol and experimenting with drugs, breaking rules and even laws, engaging in physical risk-taking like extreme sports or other dangerous activities. So what did you do?
Wait a minute. This is only an hour-long show. I did it all. I really did do it all. I rebelled in every way possible. I was a very angry young boy, man, and I literally did it all. Cussing, swearing, getting called in. My parents called to the school. I never went to jail, but it's a miracle I didn't in many ways. I really did.
Let's see, was I a rebellious teenager? It all depends on who you ask.
No, that's not an answer.
It is an answer because I know it was interesting because I do remember
can't wait to hear how you spin this.
No, I do remember a switch kind of went off where I was maybe, 11, 12, or 13, and I was nice and loving and, wanted to do stuff with my parents and da-da-da-da, or my mom anyway. And then it was just something happened where I became kind of moody and bratty. But see, I say it depends on who you ask because my brother was in and out of trouble so much.
Your brother was older than you.
My brother was
4 years.
He was
the bad boy.
He was
the
bad boy.
And you were the good girl.
Yes.
I was the third of three boys. So I saw my other two brothers, and I came in third. So I thought I knew how to skirt around the things that got them in trouble.
Right.
But I just actually made more trouble for myself.
And, well, for me also, though, it was I saw how much pressure my parents were under with my brother. I saw how much pain they were in And I didn't want to cause more pain for them.
I get it.
You know, my brother was kind of in and out of jail, in and out of trouble. And so I didn't want to cause more pain for them. So in that way, I was not a rebellious teenager. But, you know, I did have, you know, hanging out with my friends, going places I probably was not supposed to go to.
No, probably. don't question it. We're talking about our teenage years,
yes.
And that was actually a few decades ago.
It was long, more than a few,
We have a 19-year-old daughter who's just finishing up her teen years presently.
Yes.
So listen, we can also talk about more up-to-date because as a conscious parenting show, we know that the energy, just the overall energy in life has shifted over the years.
Absolutely.
It continues to shift.
Absolutely.
I don't think we had any kind of issues with our daughter my parents had with me. Nothing.
Well, it was, you know, we had a completely different approach to parenting, though.
Yes, right.
Because I remember, like, one of my greatest frustrations growing up was asking, like, well, why? Like, why? If you're going to tell me no, why? And there was never an answer. It was always because I said so. And that drove me crazy. And so when we became parents and we had a commitment to conscious parenting, which we didn't even really call it at that time. We just had a commitment to seeing and recognizing our daughter as this intelligent spiritual being.
Right.
And communicating with her that way. And so we gave her choices.
Right.
And responsibilities.
From a
very
early
age. She learned how to self-regulate very early. So we didn't do the helicopter parenting.
No, we didn't.
You know, we didn't do a lot of the stuff that I had to deal with growing up. And, you know, there's a lot of dysfunction in my home.
Yes.
So I was trying to manage that. So she didn't have that, you know, the level of dysfunction that I grew up with.
Right.
So she wasn't trying to manage that and overcome and trying to keep it together. You know, she grew up in a peaceful household.
Pretty much. We were already well on our spiritual
path.
Yeah,
and we were older parents.
And we were older parents.
Older parents.
We'd been working on ourselves for quite a number of years. And thank God, because she wasn't going to come through until we cleaned up our stuff.
Absolutely.
That's my opinion.
She's always been very clear in what worked and what didn't work for her. And yes and no. So when, you know, we did try to push our agendas and stuff, it was like it didn't go very far because she was very clear. So when you talk about teenage rebellion, especially like this need for control, you know, I see, you know, kids just pushing the boundaries and parents holding on, or parents or moms in particular talking about their level of anxiety and how afraid they are, constantly talking about their anxiety, and then they're surprised when their kid starts talking about how anxious they are.
Right, because we know as conscious parentings, we know universal law.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever I'm projecting, whatever I'm expecting, I'm creating.
Absolutely.
As for that, for my child as well as for myself. So I have an impact on my consciousness. My mind has an impact on what my daughter experiences or has the potential to experience.
Absolutely.
And if I'm scared to death, if I'm worried, mm-hmm. if I'm freaking out she may get pregnant, if all those different types of fears that grow up, people have historically have grown up with, if I continue carrying those fears, she is much more likely to have troubles than otherwise.
Yes, because we are creating that space. We're
right.
holding our level of consciousness is reflected. We are live here on News for the Soul Radio.
Live.
Call in to 646-595-4274 or email your questions to ontheair@telus.net. And even if it's not about rebellious teens, you have a question about being an empty nester or about self-regulation or anything, we will do our very best to answer it from a conscious parenting perspective
Absolutely.
Versus unconscious.
Well, yes.
which we did
unconsciously. We think we did.
And so, by the way, for those of you who are interested in getting more support or who would like to work more closely with me, I'll share with you in a little later what that could actually look like. Okay, so is it a natural cycle, this teenage rebellion and the friction between the parents? Is it natural, do you think?
I don't believe it's natural. There's a general consciousness, our individual consciousness, and there's a larger race consciousness. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to experience that kind of rebellion. It's not automatic, regardless of what experts say. Mm-hmm. The only thing that is automatic is what we actually believe ourselves is automatic, because we're projecting that out into our physical world.
So you know, it's funny. I recently did a speech in our Toastmasters group.
Right.
Three things to do for yourself before your teen leaves the nest. And one of the guys said, you know, I wish my wife had heard that before our teen left.
Heard that speech?
Yeah.
Yes.
But it wouldn't have done any good anyway, because we were total helicopter parents.
Yes, that's right.
So he owned up to be a helicopter parent. So what happens when you're being a helicopter? You're hovering. You're not trusting your kids. You're not giving them tools to actually function in the world.
You're doing it for them.
You're doing it for them.
The way you think is best.
The way you think is best.
So they do not get experience, and without experience, mm-hmm. one cannot learn and grow.
And so when you start talking about the need for control, if I'm a parent trying to control every aspect of my child's life, then yes, it would be a natural consequence for your kids to start rebelling.
Absolutely.
Simply to try to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as adults, we don't like being controlled. And so why would they?
Of course not.
And so, you know, so if you're being controlling, if you're not, you know, you want to teach your kids how to learn to listen and trust their own intuition, how to make decisions, how to self-regulate, because that's what's going to serve them in the world. You're not going to be there with them when they go off to school.
No, that's right. You know, there used to be a TV show called Father Knows Best.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that.
And that is simply not true. Father has more years and therefore more experience, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that Father knows any more, because the children's coming in today and for the last 20, 30, 40 years are more advanced consciously.
Absolutely.
Than I was when I grew up in the late 50s and early 60s. And therefore, if I think Father knows best and I'm the dad, then all I can do is project the way I grew up toward my child. And that's completely inappropriate, because my child is a whole different
yeah.
person with a different consciousness.
So I was just thinking about something recently. So yeah. our daughter is in college.
She is.
And she's going to be getting a part-time job next semester. And so she loves to sew and design costumes. So the costume teacher asked her if she wanted to work in the costume department. And, you know, we got all excited. And then she had already inquired about working in catering.
Right.
And I thought about this because from our perspective, it's like, oh, come on, work in the costume because you're interested in that. That could take you farther, you know, whatever we were making up. Because even before she was offered a job, we had even asked, oh, why don't you inquire to see if they have any work? And so what I saw, though, was I need to trust her
mm-hmm.
because it looks like, and she may be able to do both, so it's not necessarily an either or. But I need to trust her because it looks like the costume is the best thing based on our linear perspective, based on old energy of how you do this, you do this, you do this. And the catering seems like it's completely unrelated to anything that she's interested in, but yet she's interested in it. And so I was thinking that for myself, just back off.
Yes.
Back off. Trust. Oh, you were right there with me. Trust that she knows. She's following, and you know, she's always been good at this. Like, she follows her excitement and her interest, which is what we've cultivated,
mm-hmm.
and what is what we're cultivating in ourselves. And it's always worked out really well for her. So I need to trust that this is working out perfectly too, and just back off.
I have a take on that whole episode.
Okay. What?
I thought about that same thing too. And she goes to a liberal arts school, a really good liberal arts school. One of the first things the teachers or the deans announced during the parent auditorium said
mm-hmm.
is, parents, back off your kids. This is a liberal arts school. Let them explore. Let them experience. Let them try different things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why wouldn't we as parents embrace the same idea?
Mm-hmm.
Why was I thinking my daughter should go and take a part-time job in the costume department when she's already good at that? Maybe she wants to experiment with other areas of her life and see what else she might be attracted to.
Yes, I agree. And but I caught myself. It's like, okay, she can get a job here,
right?
And she can get a really cool internship.
Oh.
And then that can lead to, you know, this, or maybe it can lead to that, or it can lead to that.
Yeah, you had her life planned out.
Well, you know, in my head, I did start kind of going down that road, but because I'm committed to conscious parenting, I stopped myself,
yes.
And I said, we have cultivated in her a level of trust.
Absolutely.
We had never even heard of the school that she's attending, and it's the perfect school for her, but had it been up to us, she probably would have been at a school that we had heard of or, you know, had something, but she's found the perfect school for her. So it's about getting away from appearances, like, oh, my gosh, that looks like it's the perfect thing, and stepping into, she's excited about both. Actually, she seems more excited about the catering. So
mm-hmm.
back off and trust that if that's what she's excited about, that's the perfect
Let
the
her experience
direction.
Her life.
Yes.
And, you know, trust her.
Absolutely.
That whatever choice, she's picked that college and it is working out beautifully for her.
Well, and that is the benefit of conscious parenting, because
Absolutely.
When I'm working with parents, like, one of my dictates is create a partnership, not a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do that from the very beginning. You know, we did that from the very beginning
mm-hmm.
of even before she could talk. It was like when I was feeding her, I would ask her, do you want carrots or do you want yams? And I would just listen intuitively. And so just creating a partnership for her upbringing so that she's always in on her life. You're holding up something.
I am not. I just want to tell our fine folks out there that they can email their questions into us at ontheair@tellus.net. ONTHEAIR at TELUS.net, or you can call in to 646-595-4274.
So we are on the air live, ready to answer your conscious parenting questions. And so also in my masterclass, I talk about letting go of control as one of the tools to immediately stop the power struggles and transform your
mm-hmm.
child's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Let go of the control. You
yeah.
know, it's like, you know, like you said, I mean, you know, father knows best, but that was, you know, decades ago. And we want our kids to be in touch with their own intuition, with their own awareness, and to develop life skills to take care of themselves. I remember the women's volleyball coach from my college alma mater was complaining that the kids entering college lacks basic life skills. Okay, we have some questions.
Some of the smallest text in the world.
I don't know. If you can see
that, you can read it.
Let's see if I can read this. Heather in Minnesota, you mentioned empty nesting. The holiday season brings us up for me big time every year, even though it's been several years since my nest became empty. Nothing ever seems as special and good compared to those wonderful years when the kids were growing and our family was all together. How do we or do we ever get beyond that feeling moving forward?
I have a take on this.
Thank you, Heather in Minnesota. Yes, what is your take, Tom?
We just went through our first holidays.
Yeah, but she's home, though, so go ahead.
I have a take on this. We just went through our first holidays, and our daughter did not come back for Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's true.
She's saying she's back now for Christmas, but she did not come back for Thanksgiving or Halloween. She's a thousand miles away.
It was Thanksgiving. Holy
yeah, God. Yeah. So anyhow, I got just a taste of what you are talking about because for the Thanksgiving thing, I caught myself in my thinking, starting to feel sad, starting to go into what will we do? Our daughter's not coming home, bemoaning that. And after a little while, I kicked myself out of it and said, all right, she is going. She's loving where she's going. She's going to be there. I need to create a new life, my next phase of life for myself and my wife if she wants to participate. And so I chose to do something completely different Thanksgiving. I don't even remember what it was, but I made a conscious choice that I wasn't going to stay and bemoan my daughter's not being there because it just doesn't make sense when you have to look at each phase of our life as unfolding and we want to be the best expression of ourselves in each of those phases, whatever that means.
Sorry, I'm over here choking. Go ahead.
Yes, you're over here. Take a drink of water.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now she's here for Christmas, and it's great, but honestly, she misses her friends that she just made. She misses the
stuff to do.
So many things going on because we live in an area that has less things going on, particularly for younger people. So I get it, and I want her to be happy and fulfilled, and I want myself and my wife to be happy and fulfilled. And we were very clear when we came together for this marriage in the beginning that it was important to have our life together mm-hmm. and our own lives and then our daughter's life all at the same time because each one needs nourishing and each one is important for us to feel like we're fulfilling our life purpose.
And so just circle that up for Heather because I can't talk yet.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's like,
The only circle up is this is your children going away was of course meant to be and you probably saw it coming and our child going away was what we wanted for her. We wanted her to expand and become an adult that she wants to become. And so as she's becoming her own adult, I have a whole new phase of my life now. And if I sit back here as when I was living life as when I was a parent of a young child, I'm not present in the moment anymore. I've taken myself out of my own life purpose.
Okay.
And I don't want you to do that. I know your life has a purpose. Otherwise, you wouldn't still be here.
Okay, I think I can talk now.
We'll
thank
see.
You. Well, I know. We'll see. thank you, Heather, for that question because we've been getting it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at my life as, you know, different phases. So I had the phase before being married to Thomas. I had the phase of raising our daughter. And now I have a phase of I can do what the hell I want because I've raised, you know, my daughter. And so I miss her.
Absolutely.
But what's most exciting, so when I start missing her, what I think about is her living her best life, her calling and sharing, and there's friends in the background, and there's activities, and she's on her way to dinner with friends, or they're on their way to some event on campus. And so that's what we want as parents. We want our kids to flourish. We want them to fly. And so when I start really missing her, that gives me comfort. Also, a couple of years before I knew that she was leaving, because I homeschooled, so that means we spent a lot of time together. My social life, everything was wrapped up into homeschooling. So that was a big adjustment that I knew was coming. So I have found just things that I enjoy doing. I've upped my exercise game because I love exercising. I love having the time to exercise. We go biking and hiking and walking, and we just went to a live performance, so we love going to plays and events. So
I think you're leaving out the most critical part of your own life.
What's that?
You've actually started a new business, which you are fully studying and involved in.
I am. So I have more time for my business. But I say all that to say is we are not meant to sit around being depressed because our kids leave. It's a phase of life. And Heather, you have a purpose that mm-hmm. goes beyond being a mom. And it sounds like it's time for you to find that purpose so that you can be a fully individualized being that's happy and fulfilled, and then you still get to enjoy your kids when they're here. But you don't want to spend, these are critical years. We are not getting any younger. And you don't want to spend this time not living your life fully because you don't get it back. So I encourage you, I invite you to just step by step follow your excitement. That's like our big thing. Follow your excitement.
Well, tell her it doesn't have to. You don't have to find a big purpose
right
immediately. This is where you follow your excitement.
This is where you follow. Like each day, I get up and I say, you know, what is most exciting for me to do today? As he said, I am in a business training program, which I absolutely love because I'm expanding in more ways than I thought. But it's like, but moment to moment, it's like, what is most exciting for me? Is it working on my business? Is it going for a walk? Is it meeting him for lunch?
Is it taking a nap?
Is it taking a nap? So moment by moment, if you follow your excitement, that naturally raises your frequency so that more and more things that light you up will come into your life.
Absolutely.
Like, and Thomas said, it doesn't have to be a big thing. It may be even taking a nap. It may be having a cup of tea. It may be calling a friend and talking or meeting for lunch. But those little incremental steps will exponentially expand your life.
One of the things that we did was before our daughter left, we joined Toastmasters, mm-hmm. the public speaking club, because my wife wanted to get better at public speaking. And that's just a little thing. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, very little commitment. But it caused me to discover a part of myself that I am thrilled with that I really had no idea I would be so excited about, and that's public speaking.
And you've done more speeches than I have.
Yes, and it's given you what you asked for from it.
I love it.
Yeah, so that's just a little club. There's hundreds of them all across the country.
Yeah, thank you, Heather, for your question. Susan in New York. Do you want me to read it? Can you read it?
I can't read that.
Okay. My question is about how to foster gratitude and compassion in our younger children, especially at Christmas time when they are focused on getting stuff for Christmas instead of Christmas spirit, generosity, and kindness to others. Telling them doesn't seem to be enough.
Ah, mirroring.
Yeah. Well, you can. Let me just say my little bit. So it starts with mirroring, and Thomas is going to talk more about that. But you model the behavior that you want your kids to follow. So now you can talk more about mirroring.
Okay, and you have to be authentic.
Yeah.
You can't just model the behavior. You have to embrace the feeling and actually be it.
Yeah, instead of hoping you get that diamond ring and the thing and then trying to.
So the thing of mirroring is it's the core spiritual principles of ours that has lasted over 25 years since we first learned it. It changes the whole game in life. Everyone in our individual world, our little sphere, our children, our spouse, our best friends, are all mirrors of our consciousness. They are all reflections of what we have in our consciousness. And much of that thing, much of what we're being reflected, we love. Much of it is we're indifferent to. It's okay. And then the few things that they show us that we don't like are the key things in our life to use and transform to free us from the very thing. So let's say it's Christmas time and my child is not really grateful for what they're getting or the gifts. And what they're showing me disturbs me. Ooh, I don't like that. That child is showing you a part of your own consciousness that still is ungrateful for what's going on in life. And as long, and let's just talk about the way to transform it very quickly. The way to transform it in your is always in yourself, is to embrace it and say, okay, I see what you're doing. I'm disturbed by it. I'm going to own that. I'm not very grateful. And then forgive yourself.
Okay, let's give an example.
And yeah, of course, go ahead.
You just had a perfect one about the guy crowding you.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it is,
okay.
Absolutely.
So tell them, so we're going to give, Susan, we're going to give you an example
real
of how mirroring shows up and how it works.
Real practical. Strangers can even be the best mirrors for you, as in this example. I'm sitting in my gym on the phone on a flat surface where I can bend my knees or stretch them out. And
in the corner somewhere.
Yeah, way off in the corner. Nobody around. And so I have my knees bent in the moment. It's by the racquetball courts, nobody around. I finish up my call, and this guy comes up. Nobody around, and he comes up, and he puts his two gym bags right at my feet on this only small area where I can no longer stretch out my legs, and there's no reason for him to be there because there's plenty of places to put your bags going down the hallway in front of all the racquetball courts. So I noticed, I'm very disturbed by this. Why are you putting your stuff right on top of me? And then we get into a very heated verbal round, and he will not leave. And finally, I get up and walk off because I realize how disturbed I am. And then when I drive home, I tell my wife, Sandra, about it, and I tell her, Sandra, where am I crowding you in life? If that's all he was showing me is where I'm just going to crowd this guy who's off by himself. And I
started laughing because it was.
Yeah, it was obvious to her, and she pointed it out to me. And then I owned it. All right, I'm crowding her when I do this.
Okay, let's just give him so. For years, I have been complaining, like when I'm making dinner, and like toward the end, especially like, you know, when you've got three things you're trying to do. So we have a small kitchen, so I'm moving around. So I've been complaining for years that he will be home all day, has no need for the kitchen. As soon as I get in the kitchen, all of a sudden there's something he needs to do. Like he's crowding me. And not only that, but he'll like stand in the way. So I'm turning, and he's like right there, not doing anything, like crowding me. So I thought it was quite funny because I've been complaining about that for years. And
but have I done it anymore since that episode?
You have not.
Uh-huh. I learned it. I forgave myself. I didn't recognize it consciously what I was doing until this other guy crowded me. And I come home and ask her, where am I crowding you? Then I got it. Then I forgave myself for it.
And
Sandra will tell you the whole Ho'oponopono process of forgiveness that we often use for this very thing. Because your child is showing you that you are ungrateful and it's undeniable.
And you're lacking compassion.
Yeah.
And so, Susan, we just gave you that example because this is something we've been talking about for years, and he was unable or unwilling to see it until it was right in his face. And so he mentioned Ho'oponopono. So all forgiveness is self-forgiveness. So Ho'oponopono is an ancient Hawaiian forgiveness process. Very simple, four simple steps. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. Thank you. So whenever anything happens that disturbs me, I immediately start doing my Ho'opono work because all forgiveness is self-forgiveness. So you can just look up Ho'oponopono online. It has transformed situations beyond belief because once I release whatever energy that is creating the situation in my life, then I can have more peace and joy. So thank you,
yes.
Susan in New York.
You cannot be ungrateful for your child being ungrateful and get to gratitude, either one of you.
Okay, we have Lou in Boston.
Lou.
Our kids have it really good compared to how we grew up in our generation, but they just don't seem to get it. We especially see this in the holiday season. We are concerned that they take so much for granted. Any advice you have would be great. So, Lou, it's just the same thing we just talked about with Susan. It starts with us. It starts with us being grateful. It starts with us valuing what we have. And also, I think holding our kids responsible, like creating an environment where they're contributing in some way, they are participating, and not just, you know, giving them everything that they want. You know, making them maybe pay part of it, but contributing in a way so that they have more value for what they have. I mean, I know that, you know, growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, and I saved my allowance. I helped my dad do part-time jobs and gigs and stuff. I would keep score at the bowling alley. This was way back then, to earn extra money. And, you know, I paid for half of my car. Now, granted, my dad was a mechanic, and my first car cost $500. But as a 16-year-old, I saved my $250 because that was our agreement, and I paid for half of my car. And I loved that car, and I valued that car because my blood, sweat, and tears were in that car.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you want to add to
yes,
the boss?
Lou, I say this. Sometimes this is hard to do, but your children don't really care how you grew up. And don't, as long as you're comparing how you grew up to how it is now for them, that's going to make you unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And your children have no perspective on what you're even talking about. They never experienced that. So become present as best possible to now, because this is what you're creating for your kids now on their Christmases. And that's it. I mean, we all fall back into those comparisons and stuff, so it's not like you're the only one doing it, but as best you can, try not to.
Absolutely. And, you know, just like we told Susan, forgiveness work is a very powerful tool. So maybe you've been too generous or really trying to make sure your kids didn't suffer or have some of the hardships that you had. And so maybe you've kind of gone overboard. And so I just invite you to maybe look at that, and if so, forgive yourself and just reel it back and have them start participating and contributing more. And, you know, Christmas is really not about the stuff. It's about family and giving and love and, you know, so bring more of that.
It was about that nice jacket you got.
And, thank you, Lou in Boston. Okay, what?
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say.
Thank you, Lou in Boston. Because we still have two more questions.
Yes, let's go.
Andrea in New Zealand.
Yes.
I'm wondering what the conscious parenting approach would be for reconnecting with a daughter who has chosen to be estranged for the last several years. We don't even really know why. Ooh, what can we do?
I can speak a little to that. I estranged myself from my parents for 12 years. And I think the advice that they got from whoever was their minister at the time was probably really good advice, which was just to be open respond to your daughter if she's inviting you or inquiring to you, and try just to take it as little as you can and not expect anything. And you know, because I don't know about your daughter, but I, as a child, when I began to reconnect after 12 years, I did not even have words for why this impulse was in me trying to reconnect, or what I was looking for from them or any of that. I just felt this desire. And so I don't know if she's feeling the same thing or something similar, but there is a condition. They're not the only people who have done this. And so try to just accept whatever they can give to you and just do the best you can with an open heart.
And so, Andrea, from a conscious parenting perspective, we've talked a lot about mirroring and forgiveness. And so you may not know why, but you know what you're feeling. And so if you were to start doing your forgiveness work on her leaving, on you feeling abandoned, or you feeling frustrated or confused, to start creating a space in yourself for something else to show up. And I also invite you to really just connect with your intuition and your higher self and her higher self to ask why. Because you can actually start getting an answer about that. And then you continue to do your forgiveness work. And it may be something that she communicated over a period of time and no one listened. You know, it could be a number of different things, but really start tuning in to the pain that you're experiencing from not having your daughter in your life. Do your forgiveness work. Start clearing all of the pain and the baggage and the ugliness and all of that, so that you can actually be a clean slate. Because if she does come back and you start questioning and making her wrong, she's going to turn right around and go the opposite way. So you want to get in a place where you can just love her and allow her the freedom to reconnect. And I also think that once you start doing your forgiveness work and getting clarity, that will also create an opening, and maybe you'll want to reach out. Maybe you'll have some clarity. Even like when my daughter was younger and things would happen and she would be mad at me and I didn't know why, I would take time and I would journal about it. I would listen to my intuition. I would ask for guidance. And every time the answer dropped in. And then I would do my forgiveness work and then I would approach my daughter. So you can get to the answer from a conscious perspective, and then start forgiving. Forgiveness is key, and all forgiveness is self-forgiveness.
Okay. And I just say, whatever she can give at this moment, just accept that and try not to ask for more at the moment. And as my wife says, you know, be open and be as clean in your heart as you can. And who knows what her life past had for her when she came into this lifetime.
Yeah.
It's not all understandable all the time.
And what lesson, you know, you wanted to learn from this also. And Andrea, whatever guilt that you had, you know, Thomas mentioned that he had kind of gone away for 12 years. And so we talked about that in terms of him forgiving himself and me forgiving things that happened when I was a child, so that we did not recreate that with our daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That guilt is so powerful. You know, so we're so afraid and we're so guilty. Even if we never say anything, we're still holding the energy. Remember, everything is energy and everything is vibration.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm terrified that my daughter is going to leave me because I left my family or I did something, then I'm putting that in the space. So we were very clear on cleaning up our own stuff so that our daughter could be free.
That's why all forgiveness is self-forgiveness, because to even to carry the guilt of things I may have done wrong is not letting myself off the hook and not forgiving myself, and that energy will just try to retreat, what's the word? Will try to recreate itself over and over again until I forgive it in myself.
Yeah. Okay, Catherine, thank you. Andrea in New Zealand,
yes.
Catherine in the UK, as I watch my child raising her own children, I find it difficult to distance myself from parenting decisions I see her making that I don't agree with. Biting my tongue only goes so far. I'm truly concerned about long-term effects on the grandchildren. How would you approach something like this? You know, we're getting a lot of mirroring today.
Yeah, it is. It's mirror day.
Catherine, whatever you're seeing that disturbs you, forgive it.
because it's in you.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you want to forgive it. And then they'll be free to, it'll either disappear from your sight and perspective or they'll be free of it themselves. But everybody will end up free from it if you forgive yourself for what they're showing you that you do not like.
Yeah, and there were things that I did as a parent
mm-hmm.
that were completely opposite from my mom. And I'm sure she thought I was very wrong. You know, we let Mecca self-regulate her bedtime. We created a structure so that she was going to bed later than most children.
1 a.m. 1 a.m. What, 3?
Yeah, 4. Oh. My mother was appalled by that, but it was done consciously, you know. So we had an agreement. We had structure. So looking from the outside, a lot of things may appear wrong. But when you're doing it, when you're working it out, so I knew in my heart that that was the right decision for our daughter and our family. And so as a grandparent, I know that we, you know, my mom thought she knew what was best.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of take that with a grain of salt that, you know, do your forgiveness work. And then once you don't have a charge on it anymore, you can actually have a conversation with your daughter if it's something that you really feel could be detrimental to the children's well-being.
Yeah.
But, you know, you want to come from a place of neutrality mm-hmm. where you're observing something and then you're talking about it, because the minute you start making your daughter wrong, you know, she's just going to shut down and not have anything else to say to you about it.
Yeah.
So thank you, Catherine in New York. So I mentioned earlier, for those of you that would like more support, I invite you to contact me and schedule a conscious connection call. Because what's possible when you work with a coach is you see how we're answering the questions, but what's possible when you have someone rooting for you, when you have someone that's an observer that can stand outside, then you feel supported, you know. Every great athlete, every great business person has a coach. But parents, you know, we usually think that they can do it on their own. And so what I find is that by working one-on-one with people, their results are exponential because we're really going in and we're targeting. You know, we work on mirroring. We work on projection. We work on forgiveness. And these are the things that are going to elevate your parenting to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the session, we'll assess your biggest challenge and we'll lay out a mini plan. And if it's a fit to do more work, I'm committed to helping you create more joy and peace and less power struggles and drama in your home. Visit my website, sandrajoneskeller.com. Go to my Work With Me page and you can book a conscious connection call. It's completely free. Let's see. Oh, we have more.
Oh. What do we have?
Okay, we have 3 minutes to the top.
What do you want to say in the final 3 minutes?
All I want to say, I love how there's usually a theme to our calls.
Right.
You know, for a couple months it was empty nesting, and today it's really been mirroring and forgiveness.
Yes.
And that tool is so powerful.
It's,
and, you know, it's we use it for our relationship. It saved our marriage.
Yes, it did.
And we know we use it all the time. I used it in parenting. And so with conscious parenting is not about doing it perfect, not about not making mistakes. It's about really just recommitting and realigning. It's like, okay, whoops, I see I did this over here.
Mm-hmm.
Let me do my forgiveness work, and let me just redirect my energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so conscious parenting is not about trying to shape your child's behavior to fit your needs. It's about recognizing your child as a conscious, intelligent being with their own life purpose that is separate from yours, and you are here to be a way shower, to be a guide, to be a partner as they navigate this world finding their own life purpose.
And they are going to reflect all of your consciousness, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And the ugly.
Because they don't censor in those early years. They're just expressing.
So they don't censor in the early years, and then in the teenage years,
they over-censor.
They get that, you know, that rebellion, which we talked about.
Or shut down.
Or they shut down because they're tired of fighting. They're tired of not having any say in their own lives. And so that can be corrected. Can you show my books right quick?
I can.
So for those of you on YouTube, Thomas is showing my books, 21 Lessons to Empower the New Age Kid. This is a series of 21 lessons designed to be conversations to provide clarity, self-regulation, and agency to your kid's life. Tips and Trips of Parenting a New Age Kid is a series of essays and stories about how we raised our amazing daughter. And it's got a lot of dialogue. It's got original illustrations that were done by my husband. It's got pictures. And so it's a book that can grow with you over the years, and it's fun. You know, we talked about a lot about self-regulation, about eating, about tantrums.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a how-to book. It's if we're just sharing our approach and offering an alternative to you.
Excellent. Yeah, that's great.
So that's what I have to say. So,
both those books, Sandra Jones Keller at Amazon.com for the books.
Yeah. So we come to the end of our show. So thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, Thomas, for being my partner.
It's been my pleasure, Sandra Jones Keller.
So the Conscious Parenting Show is live the second Friday of each month. So we are off schedule right now due to technical difficulties.
We're on
but
the fourth.
We're live the second Friday of each month at 6 p.m. here on News for the Soul Radio. Please visit the News for the Soul archives for more enlightening shows, and tell all your friends. And as Thomas said, my books are available on Amazon. Thank you and happy parenting.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Next on News for the Soul Radio, it's time for Perfectly Holistic with Pam. Pam is a cat mom and holistic health seeker who, after suffering an injury that wouldn't heal, was led on a journey to seek out alternative, holistic, and natural medicine. She now shares what she learned, helping people and their cats along their path to holistic health. Pam has taken courses in holistic health for animals, muscle testing, and animal communication. Please welcome Pam back to News for the Soul.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. My name is Pam Roussel with Perfectly Holistic, and welcome to the radio show. We are so excited. We have such an amazing show tonight, and I have to say it's probably the highlight of the year. So if you are tuning in, you guys are in for a super treat. If you are watching us tonight, we are streaming on Instagram. Remember, we can't see your comments, but hop on over to YouTube or Facebook. If you want to drop a comment, let us know that you're here so we can say hello. And I want to welcome my very special guest, Dr. Richard Pitcairn, the most renowned, beloved homeopathic doctor, vet, professor, teacher, probably in the world. And we are so honored that he is here to teach us about vaccinosis in pets, which is a real thing. So Dr. Pitcairn, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. A wonderful introduction.
Well, it is much deserved, I have to say. We are just delighted that you are here, and we are, one of my whole platforms is just empowering pet parents so they can learn how to apply a more holistic approach with their pets.
Yes.
And homeopathy is one of my favorites, and it's so easy to use, but a lot of people aren't familiar with it, or they're not very confident with it. They haven't learned very much. But one of the main issues I wanted to talk about the topic tonight is because there is an over-vaccination problem around the world, and what we're seeing is chronic diseases and illnesses in pets. And a lot of that, if vets are open-minded to look behind the, you know, the curtain, a lot of times this can be linked to vaccines. And so with your knowledge and what you've studied in immunology and in practice that you've seen with pets, you've done so much research and you've put so much valuable information together that I've personally read and found so much helpful information and insight that blew my mind, actually. So thank you for sharing this information tonight. Where should we start?
Well, let me introduce what I was thinking of talking about tonight. And first of all, this is what we're calling vaccinosis, and we'll explain what that is. It's a very important topic. So it's good to bring it out. But it's also a topic like this is also a difficult one in today's culture.
Mm-hmm.
We know that talking about vaccines in any way that would seem to be saying that they're not performing well or a problem is censored, and you're criticized for it. It's a tough one to present. I appreciate that people are willing to listen to it. And what I'd like to do is say to those that will be listening to this, don't take the position of looking at it right or wrong. Just see what you can learn from it. Let's learn about vaccines and what they, I'm going to start with the very first one and how even with the first one, there were effects from them that we're seeing. And it's continued ever since. Talking about those effects is pretty much put down, and there's a very strong allegiance to vaccines by our culture. And I'm going to try to explain a little bit why that is. And we're going to go into then what was discovered in homeopathy about vaccines, because homeopathy has developed a deeper understanding of what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let's jump into it with the first slides there. Excellent.
Yeah. Go for it.
And, yeah. So I'm going to talk about smallpox. Smallpox was the first vaccine, for those of you who didn't know. And I'm going to just talk briefly about smallpox because I want you to realize, I want to have a communication that it was a very serious problem for humans. And that the doctor that developed the vaccine was very smart and very brave to do that.
Hmm.
Okay. Now there may be, we'll find that there might be some issues associated with using. Nonetheless, what he discovered has had profound effects on our experience of this disease, which we'll get into. Okay. The history of it briefly, smallpox, as far as we can tell, originated thousands of years ago. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's been thought that Egyptian traders brought it to India, that it's been an endemic human disease for at least 2,000 years.
It's hard to
see. It was probably introduced into China during the first century. The sixth century, it went to Japan from China. And when it entered Japan as a disease, the epidemic they had there killed one-third of the population.
Wow.
1/3 of all the people living in the country.
Wow.
Yeah. So let me show you some pictures here about it. I'm doing a lot of that. I know rather briefly.
You're good.
It's an amazing story. So first of all here, in the mid-18th century, which is when the smallpox vaccine was developed, it was a major endemic disease. An endemic disease means it's always present.
Mm-hmm.
And it was everywhere in the world except Australia and the small islands that had not been explored. Because when it was introduced to a country, as I described, going into Japan, it had tremendous impact. In fact, when the Spanish came to the Americas and they started to fight the Indians, they introduced smallpox, and that's what decimated the Indians, and they couldn't fight back. It's amazing. Mm. So anyway, in Europe in the 18th century, it was the leading cause of death. 400,000 people died every year from smallpox, and 1/3 of those that survived the disease went blind.
Wow.
So here's what it looks like on the face. And here you can see it affecting the whole body.
Mm.
You can see what an amazing thing it was, and how they called it the speckle monster. You can see why there was so much fear about it. So as far as the development of the vaccine, it was developed by Dr. Edward Jenner. He was a doctor in England. And what he observed was that milkmaids, the milk cows, would sometimes get cowpox from the cows.
Hmm.
It was a very similar disease, but it was mild compared to smallpox. But if they did get cowpox, it was observed that they didn't then seem to ever get smallpox. So, for example, Jenner heard a dairy maid say, "I shall never have smallpox, for I have had cowpox. I shall never have an ugly pockmarked face." In fact, it was a common belief that dairy maids were in some way protected. So this intrigued him. Yeah. He thought maybe if somebody was given cowpox, they would become immune, because he said they had no immunity to it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did the first experiments in 1796, and he found a dairy maid who had fresh cowpox lesions on her hands and arms. He took some of the material that was oozing out of those sores, and he scratched them into the skin of an 8-year-old boy, James Phipps, who was the son of one of his workmen. The boy then developed mild fever and some discomfort in the axillae, which is the armpits. 9 days after that was done, he felt cold, lost his appetite, but the next day he was much better and he recovered. So then, now that was in May, then in July, he inoculated the boy with smallpox, the actual disease. You think how brave that was?
Yeah, I don't think I'd volunteer.
Oh, no. And the boy didn't get sick.
Wow.
And then he did the same kind of a test on his own son. First gave him cowpox, and then later smallpox, and he also was protected. So that stimulated him to move on. This is how it began.
Yep.
And the whole story of the vaccine we can't go into, but it's fascinating. It wasn't accepted for a long time, the ups and downs. But eventually it was seen to be very effective and spread around the world and became mandatory. All right, so I want you to understand how threatening that disease was for centuries,
mm-hmm.
and why then to have a vaccine work was embraced with such enthusiasm. However, now that was 1796. Look at, though, in 1916, for example, here's a quote from a doctor who was the vice president of a medical society. And he says, "Concerning the cause of this disease," and he's talking about polio, "I think my professional brothers will be somewhat startled when I suggest that the present epidemic of infantile paralysis may have been caused by smallpox vaccination." This is clear back in 1916.
Wow.
He says, "You smile, but why should the increase become epidemic in New York City, an endemic throughout our entire country, so soon after the wholesale process of vaccination started?" Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He says, "It may furnish you food for candid reflection, since we know that tuberculosis has increased 300%, skin disease is 276%, and cancer 600% since the introduction of compulsory vaccination. So you see that even back then, after smallpox vaccination, the very first vaccine, already there was evidence that it caused susceptibility to other diseases. Mm-hmm. And it has continued that way ever since, though you don't hear much about it.
Right, right.
Okay. So let's go back to Jenner's work then, because it's interesting. I want to emphasize here, tuberculosis has increased 300%. That's what this doctor had observed.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to Jenner's work. James Phipp, the boy he first did it with, died of tuberculosis at age 20. And his son, who was vaccinated more than once, also died from tuberculosis at age 21.
Wow.
See, but Jenner, I don't think, saw the relationship.
Right.
Okay? So, nonetheless, with the development of vaccination programs and so many large numbers of people being vaccinated and very obvious improvement in you know, not having a smallpox so often, it was obviously working. And there were suggestions, like we just went over, I just gave you a little bit of it. You know, there's lots of reports of problems associated with after the vaccines in some people.
Mm-hmm.
So why wasn't that accepted more? Because it was considered how terrible the disease of smallpox was. This was worth the risk. And mm-hmm. that's the view of today. So even when, you know, reports come out about, are there are problems with vaccines, doctors will say there might be some, they're minimal, it's still worth doing the vaccine. It's still a much greater good. Does that make sense? You understand?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So let's look at some of the effects of vaccines in animals. We're still kind of mainstream view here. So, for example, in Purdue University, the veterinary school, they did several studies to see if vaccines could cause damage the immune system of dogs, if it could lead to life-threatening immune diseases. And they did this research because there was concern about this, obviously. They found that the vaccinated, compared to the non-vaccinated, developed autoantibodies, antibodies against their own body tissue,
mm-hmm.
including fibronectin, laminin, DNA, all these things listed here. I know some of it doesn't make sense to you, but just get the idea that they did find there was a lot of autoimmune disease in dogs, not necessarily every one, but still mm-hmm. a significant number. And I'll give you a little more detail on it. For example, when they had antibodies against fibronectin is important in tissue repair, multiplication of cells, growth and differentiation between the tissues and organs in a living organism. And the other one, the dogs that had antibodies against laminin is involved in cellular activities that are the adhesion of cells and tissues together, spreading of cells, differentiation of cells into different types, proliferation and movement of cells. And they say in that what I copied here, vaccines thus appear to be capable of removing the natural intelligence of cells. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a report from a veterinary school.
Wow.
They also found that they reacted to collagen. And collagen, one quarter of all the protein in your body is collagen.
Mm-hmm.
It provides a structure to our bodies. It protects the soft tissues, connects the tissues to the skeleton.
Yep.
It's no wonder that the canine health cancers of 1997 study of 4,000 dogs showed a high number of dogs developing mobility trouble after they were vaccinated.
Mm.
Okay.
Wow.
One more thing here in regard to cats. The AVMA, American Medical Veterinary Association, did a vaccine-associated feline sarcoma task force. Did a study of 160,000 cats each year that, they did studies to find out why 160,000 cats each year developed terminal cancer at the vaccine information sites. How many of you have heard of that? You've
yes.
heard of it?
Uh-huh. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
The fact that cats can get vaccine-induced cancer has been acknowledged by veterinary bodies around the world. And even the British government has acknowledged it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's known, but you don't hear much about it generally.
Right.
In America, this is hard to accept. In America, in an attempt to mitigate the problem, that is, assuming that that might happen to a cat, they recommend vaccinating cats in the tail or mm-hmm. leg so they can amputate it when the cancer appears. Clever veterinarians, right?
It's terrible. That blew my mind when I learned that. I just was like, are you freaking kidding me?
No.
It's not. Yeah, that sounds like a really good plan.
Well, it gives you some idea. That's very brief, I know, but it gives you some mm-hmm. idea that there have been issues with vaccines from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues are minimized because of the beneficial effects from vaccines. No question that they reduce the incidence of disease, but we're going to go into this on a deeper level now.
Okay.
We're going to go into what has been discovered because a lot of this investigation in this direction has not really been supported much in medicine, but in homeopathy, it was, and there have been further discoveries, and that's what we're going to talk about now. So can we go to the next file
yes.
there, which is the...
Yes. Let's mm-hmm. do this. Here we
yeah.
go. Yeah.
So what's been learned, we call it, it's called vaccinosis. It's interesting that the word vaccination came from the word vacca, which is a Latin word for cow.
Oh.
For the cowpox.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's where it came from.
Okay.
So vaccinosis was the name that was given to diseases following vaccination by homeopathic practitioners. So we're going to go look at that. So here's what we're going to cover, hopefully, if we have the time.
Mm-hmm.
The discovery of vaccinosis by this Dr. J. Compton Burnett. What is vaccinosis? How is it transmitted? How does it appear in dogs and cats? And can a disease actually be eradicated with vaccines? That's what I'd like to cover.
Perfect.
So here's J. Compton Burnett. Here's when he lived in 1840 to 1901. He was a doctor that practiced in the, as you see, he got his degree in 1878. And he developed a homeopathic practice in London. And for most of his career was an outspoken proponent of the homeopathic method because he saw such wonderful results with it. And he did several books. If anybody's interested that is interested in homeopathy or studying homeopathy, his books are very informative. And he talks about treating, for example, one of his books is treating children that don't develop properly, mentally or physically, treating cancer, treating cataracts. It's very interesting stuff. So anyway, mm-hmm. he's the one that discovered this. And he did, after observing effects from the smallpox vaccine primarily, he did this book. This was published in 1884, and it's called Vaccinosis and Its Cure by Thuja, which is a homeopathic remedy,
mm-hmm.
with remarks on homeoprophylaxis, which means prevention of the disease. And the primary vaccine he experienced was smallpox, but there might have been perhaps a little bit later some other ones. And you see here that on the timeline, in the 18th century, we had in 1797, the smallpox vaccine. But then in the 19th century, we had 1879, we had cholera vaccine, rabies in 1885, tetanus, typhoid fever, bubonic plague, and so on. So he might have had some experience with that, but he talks in his book primarily about the smallpox.
Okay.
So what is vaccinosis? I'm going to speak to this. This is from a understanding from a homeopathic perspective. And those of you who don't know homeopathy, just bear with me. It's a system of medicine that was developed over 200 years ago by a doctor that discovered some principles, how medicines could be used to basically stimulate healing and displace the disease that was there. And the way it was done was to use a medicine that would produce a similar pattern of disturbance. And it was found that the consciousness of the individual could only focus on one at a time, either disease influence or what he called a remedy influence. So in other words, if you had a say, a disease that caused nausea and vomiting, and then you gave an herb that caused the same kind of pattern of nausea and vomiting, that the attention would be given to one or the other, not both.
Mm-hmm.
And if the attention was given to the remedy, which he learned how to do, we don't have time to go into, but he learned how to do that, then the disease influence disappeared, and the person became well. Okay. Now, one of the major discoveries that Dr. Hahnemann, who developed homeopathy, learned is that there's what he calls the life force.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an energy or a spirit-like, he calls a spirit-like dynamic or an energy that operates the physical body. He said the physical body is just an instrument.
Yep.
It has no intelligence of its own. It can't do anything on its own. It's run entirely by what he called the life force, this energy that runs it. Okay? Now, here's what's relevant. I hope I'm not going too fast, Pam.
No, you're good. You're
okay.
Good.
I'm trying to get in as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So what's relevant here is that as an outcome of that understanding from homeopathic perspective, that we human beings are basically an expression of life force. It's also true of dogs and cats. It's also true of plants.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true of viruses and bacteria.
Mm.
They all have a life force that's responsible for there being a physical manifestation.
Yeah.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that life force of the virus, so say if it's a virus, the life force of a virus that's responsible for a disease, it is what basically runs the viral, how can I put it? It's life, it's growth, it's
yep.
what makes a virus spread, reproduce itself. It's a living being.
The blueprint. It runs the blueprint.
Yeah, it runs the whole show.
Yep.
Okay. The physical expression, which is the physical virus, is part of it, but it's not really the dynamic that runs it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's the life force of the virus that runs it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when a viral disease has been modified, what they call modified live virus vaccines, the virus has been grown in other animals so that it adapts to those animals and mm-hmm. now no longer grows very well, let's say, in humans or dogs or whatever it is. Then when it's put back into, say, the human being, it doesn't grow very well, but it does produce immunity.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The physical expression of it was altered.
Yeah.
But the life force of the vaccine is the same. So when a vaccine is injected into a person or an animal, you are injecting the life force of the virus.
Mm. Okay.
So the disease is being communicated.
Mm.
Now, if it's a vaccine that's been modified, killed vaccine or modified live vaccine, it's been modified in such a way that it no longer manifests the same physical expression.
Yeah.
But you are transmitting the same disease. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
You're manifesting the same life force. I mean, you're communicating the same life force of the disease that you're trying to protect against.
Yep.
So the disease has been changed, so it doesn't express in the same way. It's now very mild, perhaps, or very little evidence of it growing, but the life force is still communicated. So that when you have a mandatory vaccine program where everybody has to get it, what that comes down to is that everyone is given the disease. Whereas in a natural state,
mm-hmm.
where there is an epidemic, not everybody gets the disease.
That's true.
But when there's a mandatory vaccination program, everybody gets the disease.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yes.
So this is why there's problems and health issues that follow vaccination, as discovered by Dr. Burnett. In other words, the life force of the virus or the life force of the bacteria, whatever is being used as a vaccine, though it may not communicate or manifest the same disease, which is people are very happy about, of course.
Yep.
Nonetheless, it's going to have some effects on your health. It's
yeah.
going to manifest in a different way. Mm-hmm. Though milder, perhaps, but still, it's going to have effect.
Yeah.
All right? So let's look at some of that. Unless you have a question about this, did I make it clear enough?
No, I'm very clear. Okay. Yeah, keep going. All right. I think we're good.
All right, so let's look at then animal vaccinosis. So we're going to talk about how it looks in some animals. So I'm going to talk here first about the stemper. Can you see the whole slide? It's cut off at the top of my screen, but it's okay.
Yeah, I think we can see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here are the symptoms of distemper as occurs in dogs, okay? These are the natural symptoms, so to speak.
Okay.
All right, not the vaccine, just the natural disease.
Right.
A watery eye discharge, a nose discharge, conjunctivitis, which is inflammation of the eye, mm-hmm. vomiting, diarrhea, loss of appetite, watery feces, mucus, bloody, foul odor, severe fetid diarrhea. Fetid is very, very bad smelling diarrhea.
Yep.
Spasms and seizures, paralysis of the legs, eruptions around the mouth at the hairline, swelling of the feet, red foot pads, pneumonia, skin eruptions, pussy lesions on the abdomen and inside the thighs, and emaciation, loss of weight. So those are the natural symptoms. So what I'm going to show you here, we're going to go through these. Over here are the same symptoms I just went over with you.
Mm-hmm.
And here is how it expresses in the dog as vaccinosis symptoms.
Uh-huh.
Now, a dog with vaccinosis won't have all of these symptoms.
Right.
It might only have one or two. That's the way vaccinosis manifests itself. It uh-huh. isn't going to, because there's going to be more in the next slide. But you can see now, maybe you've seen, those of you that had dogs that have had problems, you might recognize some of this. So one of them, the watery discharge from the eyes and nose, well, dogs will have a tendency for watery fluid to drip from the nose.
Mm-hmm.
Conjunctivitis, where some dogs will have chronic eye inflammation with eye discharge, and entropion it's called, where the eyelid stick comes in. Vomiting, diarrhea, loss of appetite. They can have chronic gastritis, stomach inflammation, hepatitis, which is inflammation of the liver, of the pancreas, appetite disorders chronically.
Mm-hmm.
And then watery feces, fetid diarrhea, all this stuff, manifesting as parvovirus.
Yep.
It's a different form that distemper has taken.
Yep.
We'll get into that a little bit later. Recurrent chronic diarrhea in dogs, food sensitivities with diarrhea, and then the symptom of spasms, fits, and seizures, and paralysis of the limbs. You'll see dogs having epilepsy, really not unusual symptom. Mm-hmm. Paralysis of the rear leg and spondylitis, inflammation of the spinal cord.
Yeah.
All right. So those are vaccinosis symptoms. Okay, carrying on with distemper, eruptions around the mouth where the hair meets the skin of the lips, what's called lip fold dermatitis in dogs, or allergic eruptions on the face. Then we have swelling of the feet, red foot pads is a natural symptom. This is a rather common one. Some of you have probably really struggled with this, where the dog has this habit of constantly licking its feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll sometimes have eruptions between the toes, sometimes inflammation and swelling of the toes or the bottoms of the feet, and then inflammation of the skin between the toes.
Yep.
Then we have pneumonia, which appears now as kennel cough.
Mm.
We have eruptions of the skin, chronic skin eruptions in dogs, not uncommon at all.
Yep.
Emaciation, dogs failing to thrive,
mm-hmm.
abnormally thin condition, and having very poor appetites.
Yes.
Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say that I know many clients also have seen similar symptoms like this in cats too.
Okay.
So, yeah, it can happen to cats.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If there's time, I'll go into cats. We're doing pretty well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I have time to cover it. So let's go to the next one here. We're going to talk about rabies. This is a really interesting one. Rabies, I'd say, it's usually more observable vaccinosis symptoms of rabies than with the other diseases. You can recognize the other ones after you catch on to it.
Mm-hmm.
But rabies is sometimes pretty darn obvious.
Yeah.
Because that really nice little happy friendly dog gets rabies and 2 days later it's quite different. So here are symptoms of natural rabies. So we have the restless and uneasy, apprehensive and vicious, avoiding company, or wanting unusual affection and attention because they're anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Desire to travel away long distances. That's a very common one. Sometimes you can't keep a dog confined, no matter what you do. They can't be restrained. If you try to restrain them with leash or something, they'll attack it. They'll bite themselves and cause severe wounds to themselves. They'll give out strange cries and hoarse howls. Loss of appetite, no interest in food, unable to swallow, paralysis of the throat.
Yeah.
We have staring eyes with dilation of the pupils, or they can't close their eyes, the cornea dry and dull, hanging down of the lower jaw. The behavior of swallowing wood, stones, and inedible objects. A destruction of any blankets or clothing that's around. Convulsive seizures, incoordination, throat spasms with severe pain, increased sexual desire, inflammation of the heart or disturbed heart function, and excited and jerky breathing. These are all symptoms of natural rabies.
Yeah.
All right, so let's do the same thing here. Here are the natural symptoms. So the restless uneasiness and apprehensive and becoming vicious, they appear exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
After the vaccine, they became restless. They are now suspicious of others. They become unfriendly to other dogs. They become vicious to other dogs and try to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be aggressive and mistrust strangers, especially people in uniforms.
Interesting.
Then we have dogs normally affectionate. They hide away and shun company.
Mm-hmm.
And we have changes of behavior to being very aloof and becoming, going from affectionate to not affectionate. Dogs normally independent may become unusually attentive. And they can be just the opposite, very clingy behavior and fear to be left alone. You can't leave them in the house alone. You can't leave them in the car alone anymore.
Yeah.
They follow the client all around the house. They always want physical contact.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that follow rabies vaccine. Some of you may have seen it. The tendency to escape confinement and to roam. I already mentioned that, where they'll dig out from under a wall. You can't, it does leap over it. They'll do anything to get away, and they'll roam for miles. Any attempt to restrain them, they'll get hysterical and violent. They'll cause self-injury. And then this self-mutilation, they'll chew their tail and cause damage to it, chew off their toes sometimes.
Mm.
Very odd. And then we have the strange cries and hoarse howls. You'll notice after vaccination, some dogs, their voice will change and become hoarse.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an excessive tendency to bark and be vocal. That's very common.
Mm-hmm.
The no interest in food becomes a chronic poor appetite. They're very finicky, unable to swallow because the muscles of the throat are now weak or paralyzed. And you can see dogs now sometimes after vaccination where they have partial paralysis of the mouth. They're sloppy eaters and drinkers. They have tendency to drool. Eyes staring with dilation of pupils. They have loss of sight, cataract formation, visual defects. Unable to close the eyes, the cornea becomes dry and dull. It's what's called dry eye, keratitis. Mm. Swallowing wood and stones and so on. Dogs after a vaccination will start eating wood and stones and stick and excessive desire to eat stool. There's their own stool in other animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have destruction of bedding, blankets, towels, clothing, and the same destructive behavior you'll see where they're kept in a kennel and they'll destroy all the blankets that are in there. And then we have convulsive seizures, muscular incoordination. We have seizures, epilepsy, chorea, twitches, and ataxia in dogs after being vaccinated. Epilepsy is a rather common one, unfortunately.
Can you tell people what ataxia means who may not know?
Yeah, trouble moving. They stumble,
yep.
Falling back and forth. They can't walk easily. They can't walk in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
Trouble using their legs and placing them properly.
Yeah.
And they have pain in their and constriction in the throat and spasms of the throat, and it's called psychomotor seizure syndrome in veterinary medicine. It's seen as exactly that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Increased sexual desire, you'll see that in neutered males even after vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
They start humping and trying to be aggressive. Inflammation of the heart muscle is a natural symptom. In dogs, you'll sometimes see them with irregular pulse or heart failure. And then we have, this is an interesting one where the natural symptom of being of excitement and jerky breathing, or what's called cluster breathing, is seen in dogs after being vaccinated. They call it reverse sneezing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
You're doing pretty good. I think I'm going to go on here to, I think we have time to do panleukopenia. Is that what it says at the top? I can't see the top of my slide.
Yes, that's right.
So this is cats. So they have, here are the natural symptoms. And I won't go through all of them. Let's just go ahead and look at the table here. So the natural symptom of lassitude, where they are just lay around. They don't want to do anything, indifferent to people, other cats, or surroundings. This is a natural symptom of panleukopenia.
Mm.
Now you'll see after the vaccine, cats now become very lazy and do the same thing. They just lie around now. They don't have much interest. The second one is loss of appetite. Not unusual in cats. Appetite trouble, very finicky. Mm-hmm. Doesn't want to eat well. People are always struggling with it. And natural symptom of fever. I've actually seen cats with chronic fever for weeks.
Oh, wow.
For weeks going on, never stopping. But they may not have very many other symptoms. Mm-hmm. They might have enlargement of the throat glands, possibly the lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. But this chronic fever, it's not very common, but I have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
The rough, unkempt coat is a natural symptom. You'll find cats that now become very poor groomers or never groom anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The symptom of dehydration, you'll see that sometimes in cats leading to cystitis and bladder calculi. Rapid weight loss, what we think of as skeletal cats, they become very emaciated or become hyperthyroid.
Mm-hmm.
Cats that are now vomiting, the natural symptom of vomiting, profuse watery diarrhea. We now call it inflammatory bowel disease when we see it in cats after vaccination.
Yep.
Much mucopurulin from the eyes, fluid. Also a very similar thing with upper respiratory infections and sinusitis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Now, I want to go to, this is another point I want to emphasize here. On May 8th, 1890, the World Health Assembly announced that the world was free of smallpox because of the smallpox vaccination. And they recommended all countries stop vaccinating. And they say here, as you can see, the world and all its peoples have won freedom from smallpox, which was the most devastating disease sweeping in epidemic form through many countries since earliest time. Well, you know, as we talked about, it was a terrible disease. This is an amazing result, isn't it? Don't
mm-hmm.
we have to acknowledge that what Jenner did apparently eradicated smallpox from the world?
Interesting.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
More cases have been recorded since 1977. But here's, Pam, where I want to, we're going to go at the end of the branch together, okay?
Okay, let's do it.
Again, from a homeopathic perspective, what we understand about these viruses and bacteria, as well as, you know, people and animals, how do we interpret this presumed eradication?
I think the first thing you look at is, okay, well, what has replaced it?
Exactly.
What other diseases and stuff are we dealing with now instead of that?
Instead of that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at it from this angle. Let me ask you.
Yeah.
Do you believe there is some kind of a phenomenon that we call reincarnation?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Where we die physically, but then we take a new form.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Does reincarnation happen with just humans, or does it happen with dogs and cats and other animals?
I believe it happens to all living beings.
All right. Now, here's the question, Pam. Ready?
Yeah.
Does it happen with viruses?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
If we're going on the same presumption that it's a life force, then I guess it is.
Yes. That's what I think is the I'm not putting down that smallpox was eradicated, but I want to say it's not eradicated in the sense it's now permanently gone. The life force of the virus takes a new form.
New form.
A new disease. It may not be as bad a disease. Maybe it's HIV or something. I don't know, you know. But still, it's not like gone from human experience. Not
right.
This way of doing it. It might be possible for it to, we think, well, we can't go into this. there is the idea in homeopathy that it might be possible that it could be actually eradicated completely, even that life force could be eradicated. But let's leave it at that. We don't have time to go into that. But does that make sense to you at all?
Absolutely. And it also makes me think that, you know, how our genes contain genetic material that has been passed down for generation to generation to generation to generation. So sometimes those things actually manifest in physical form in our lives, and sometimes we don't show any of that, and we keep passing it on to our offspring, right? So that makes me think of that too. Like, maybe we don't see it, but it doesn't mean that it, you know, somewhere along our genetic material, that memory still could be there. And maybe that's what makes us, some people, more susceptible to getting certain diseases and other people not.
Yeah, I think really that what I wish to communicate is that our minds should be open to learning more. And it's, you know, there's a lot learned about viruses and diseases and epidemics and all that, which is wonderful material. But I think, for example, what's been done with homeopathy to find out there's more to it than we understood. Yeah. We're going deeper into it. So I think from this, we could say, okay, that doesn't mean we should take from what we're looking at here and say, oh, vaccines are bad. We should say, let's move on. Let's find other ways that we can deal with this now that we understand it better.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to promote here, okay?
Yes, yes.
So we have probably about we still have another 10 minutes or so?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me see if I have, I thought it might end here. Let me very briefly just do a little bit on this.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say how vaccines have increased in their use, just now that we've talked about vaccines and how they might be having effects that last a long time, even inherited. As an example, for me, I was born in 1941, and I received DPT and smallpox, four vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in 1954, a polio vaccine came out. I got that one. And then a second one, the Sabin vaccine in 1956. So by the time I was an adult, I received six vaccines. And I don't remember if they were repeated. But in today's world, in the 2020 plus, a child by the time they're 2 years old has received 72 vaccinations.
This what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. This is very significant.
Ah.
So I believe the vaccination method has been effective in reducing the incidence of disease, but there may be better ways to do it. Possibly we could consider that. There also, we have to consider also that there are some health effects might be associated with a vaccine that we have to know about and be able to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is pretty much what I said here. So I think we can stop here. We don't need to. I'm using a slideshow that I did other places, so it goes on.
Yeah.
And on.
No,
so
you're good. You're good.
Questions, huh?
Well, one of the things that I think pet parents would benefit knowing is how T cell memory records that information when a pet is vaccinated, when they are. They're able to defend their bodies from the said, you know, pathogen, bacteria, virus, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So is there a need to keep redoing it and redoing it and redoing it? And if not, why is that?
Well, what Pam's referring to here is there's two major, the immune system is amazing. It's just an amazing system, very complex in a way. But there's two major actions. If you have a natural disease, say you get a, you know, whatever the disease is, it doesn't matter, flu or whatever, smallpox. Your immune system is going to react.
Mm-hmm.
There is a significant difference between bacterial infections, fungal infections, and viruses. Okay. Mm-hmm. Bacteria, like strep or staph or something like that.
Yep.
Tetanus. The bacteria grow in the tissues. In the fluid around the cells, they use the nutrients, they reproduce themselves, and they can release some toxic material that kills the cells and so on, okay? They live in the fluid around the cells. The virus lives inside the cells. So the immune system can't recognize them because they're only inside the cells. You see the problem? Mm-hmm. So what it's learned to do is that as a virus is growing in the cell, the surface of the cell is modified as the virus is growing to produce what we could, in current times, what they call the spike protein. These proteins are put out on the surface of the cell so the virus can use them as it leaves the cell and grows. And the immune system learns to recognize that. But the antibodies can't do anything about it. So they use a cell called a T cell, where they're killer cells. And what happens is the immune system acts, it moves around, the T cells move around in the blood and the fluid, and when they recognize that a cell is growing virus inside of it, it kills the cell.
Smart. Yeah. It's smart. Our immune system is smart. It knows what to do.
Yeah. So there is a difference there. And vaccines will do a similar thing, especially if they're modified live. Killed vaccines, not so much. Killed vaccines more focus on antibody because they don't really grow in the body. Let's not go there.
Yeah.
What you want to refer to is here is the
duration of immunity.
The what? The immunity. It's observed that a natural immunity, like if you get measles or mumps. measles or mumps, for example, as a child, it's known that if you develop, you recover from it.
Yep.
You develop immunity. That immunity is lifelong.
Yeah.
That's well established in immunology. The same thing happens in dogs and cats. So if they're vaccinated and they develop immunity to distemper, they do not have to get the vaccine again. They are immune for life.
Thank you.
Now, if they didn't get immunity, you can repeat it, but it's not really doing such a great job.
Right.
Okay. So the repetition of vaccines is to a great extent is not necessary.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm just talking from the understanding of immunology.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that has been studied for years, and immunologists have been shouting this from the rooftops for years, but there's very few veterinary ears out there that want to hear that.
Because they think it's very possible that not every animal necessarily, when I say that it's lifelong, I guess there could be some exceptions now and then of an animal that doesn't go lifelong, what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm talking generally speaking, almost all of them have lifelong immunity. But the problem is some of the vaccines don't give lifelong immunity because they're not that good a vaccine.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yep.
So they repeat them. Also, it feels safer. It has other reasons for doing, financial and otherwise.
We do have another question for you, Dr. Pitcairn. Jenny says, how can we undo vaccinosis? Is there one remedy that always works on rabies or a remedy that always works on panleukemia? What do you say to that?
No, there's not one remedy. The Thuja, which is the one that was mentioned by Burnett, is one of the major remedies. It works in a lot of cases. But there are other remedies sometimes instead. And it's the same in homeopathy. It's the same process. Those of you who understand homeopathy know that what you do is you find a remedy that will produce similar symptoms. And that's what's curative. Now, it may be Thuja. It might be sulfur. It might be silica. There are a number of remedies that are known to be effective against vaccination or vaccinosis. And so if you know homeopathy, what you do is you look at the symptoms of the animal and you pick the remedy that's the best fit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I want to emphasize to you that homeopathy can cure vaccinosis very well. One dose can do it.
Yeah.
It's very, very effective in curing vaccinosis.
Here's another question. Do you need to use a remedy even if there are no side effects from a vaccine? Would it be beneficial?
No.
No?
But, you have to be observant.
Right.
You saw some of the things that were kind of subtle, like the watery nose.
Yeah.
If you weren't paying attention, you'd think there were no symptoms. But if you do start to see some symptoms, is it possible for people that are listening to this, can they download the paper
If you send me, oh yeah, I have the chart. I have the chart.
You know, if they could download the charts, that'd be really helpful.
I do.
Because then they would know how to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't see any symptoms at all, the animal seems just fine. Not every animal or person is affected and develops vaccinosis.
Yeah. And sometimes it takes a while for them to start to show problems, correct?
Yes, it can be a few weeks. It can be in a few days as behavior changes. It's possible.
Yeah.
I see that in rabies.
Mm-hmm.
But it can also be, as you said, a few weeks down the line, they develop a problem.
Yep.
And so it's good to remember that and be attentive to the possibility that the vaccine received may be a factor here.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter, because if you're doing homeopathy, you still go by the symptoms that are present and find a remedy that matches.
Right.
To resolve it.
Rachel says, is the rabies vaccine necessary to repeat for cats?
I don't think so, though. I don't know that there's really been what could be considered adequate research to show that. You see, you imagine, if you're going to do that, you're going to study that, you're going to do research on that question, okay? How would you do it? You would take a number of cats. I know it's kind of a nasty thing to say here, but to do this to them. But say you take 20 cats. When they're young, you give them the rabies vaccine. You then maybe you've shown that the vaccine's effective. Maybe by then, just like Jenner did, two or three months later, give them the rabies virus, and if they don't get sick, then you assume that they're immune. Okay, now to know if it's lifelong, we have to let them go for years,
mm-hmm.
live out 15 years or so, and test them through their lifetime until mm-hmm. at the end of their life. When they die, you can say, we tested them all along and they were still immune.
Right.
But nobody's done that.
Well, doesn't a titer test help measure that?
Titer is a test for antibody.
Okay.
You can have a positive titer and not be adequately immune to a virus because it takes the T cells.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. What if you were to do a titer test like within 2 weeks of giving them a vaccine just to see if they have and if there are antibodies present?
Sure.
And then you wait and just see how they, see how they.
Well, I certainly think you could do that with distemper or Panduke or whatever,
mm-hmm.
The rabies is a little more tricky, but because of its significance to us, that's fine, but what I was talking about before is actually doing a scientific study
mm-hmm.
to answer the question.
Yeah.
You look and see if there's a titer, fine.
Yeah.
But we have not determined if titer is sufficient. We've never done a study like that. We haven't determined how much titer you need.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Jenny says, and we have time for one more question. She says, not sure how to ask this, but you know how rabies caused Charlie's FHS, but we didn't know it until 1.5 years afterwards. Does that mean I missed the signs in the beginning and it just got worse? So if a cat develops a chronic illness that kind of shows up months, maybe a year later, I'm sure it's easy to overlook that you didn't notice those symptoms post-vaccination
right.
at the time because you just didn't know that it was a thing, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then
we look for that time association.
Yeah. And so back to our original premise that vaccines can contribute to chronic illnesses,
mm-hmm.
I would say that it's very likely that his chronic illness could have been linked to just too many vaccines, right?
Yes, I would say from my experience that that's very possible, very likely. But again, you can't be certain about it unless you see an association. Like
mm-hmm.
if you get the vaccine, you see some changes in the health of the animal, say within the month, then it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
If it's 6 months down the line, I don't know. You can't be certain. It may be very possibly due to the vaccine. But then on the other hand, maybe there was some other factor, you see. So
yeah. some contributing factors on top of that. Like
exactly,
yeah, exactly. Like diet and sleep sick meds and, you know, environmental toxins and everything else. It's like a cumulative toxic burden we're putting into our cats, you know, or dogs.
Exactly.
You know, so I think you look at the cumulative effect over all of those toxins, and it can certainly start to throw the whole immune system out of whack.
Sure, because the life force, from the homeopathic perspective, the life force is very, very powerful and maintains a healthy state unless something interferes with it.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about now more than one interference. There could be the vaccine. There could be the diet, contaminated food. There can be emotional stress, right? There'll be all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And they all add up, and they, you know, just as we, any of us would understand, the more things are coming at you like that, the harder it is for you to function.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I cannot believe our time is already up. This has been so amazing and so interesting. We have a lot of good comments over here on the side. Just thank you so much for sharing your information. And this will be... this will live on these channels so that you guys can go back and share this video with somebody that has a pet because they need to know this information. Any last thoughts, Dr. Pitcairn, before we say goodbye? Do you have, like, where can people find you?
I'd like homeopathy to become more accepted and used, which is not really the trend. There's a lot of resistance against it. But I've been doing homeopathy for over 45 years, and I'm really impressed with it. And I think that we didn't have time to go into it, but you can use homeopathic, homeoprophylaxis. In other words, you can give a remedy instead of a vaccine and develop immunity to disease.
That's amazing.
You know? So there's a lot that can be developed there. I wish it would be, but, you know, our culture is going to have to change. It's a real, right now we're in a real cultural problem, crisis, I don't know what you want to call it, you know, that, you know, we don't want to give up our beliefs. We just don't want to give them up. And until we are willing to open our minds, and that's why I say at the beginning, let's not slip into making people good and bad. Let's look at how can we encourage people to look and to have willingness to consider. That's what we have to do, we humans.
Just be open-minded and be willing to learn something that you didn't
learn. Something.
Yes.
Exactly. To recognize the need to it. We need to learn more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. When we stop learning, we stop growing.
Yeah.
So, and our pets give us opportunities every day to learn something if we are paying attention.
Right.
So, anyway, thank you guys so much. I just wish all of our viewers a wonderful Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And thank you again, Dr. Pitcairn, for being here to share your wisdom and teach us a little bit about vaccinosis. And I hope that pet parents will feel empowered to do better now that they know better. So with that, thank you guys. We will see you next month. Have a blessed evening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
All right. Let's see.
Yeah, man, we all love to hear the good news, so we all should rush to hear the good news. But we can just find the good news. NSTN, NSTN, news for the soul at the very best. NSTN, NSTN, news for the soul at the very best. NSTN, NSTN, news for the soul at the very best. Yeah, man, just log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Can you hear me? We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you...
Blog Talk Radio.
It began with one journalist fighting three incurable diseases and raising two young children on her own. Launching a positive news newspaper in January 1997. Over the years, the spirit-driven project survived, transformed, and eventually thrived. And now, in 2012 and beyond,
NewsForTheSoul.com is continuing to bring truly life-changing talk radio to the entire world. Here's your host and founder of News for the Soul Broadcasting, Nicole Whitney.
It's not just a show. It's a movement. You're listening to News for the Soul, the number one life-changing radio show in the world, according to Google and AOL, and the largest free life-changing audio resource on the web. We feature the top luminaries in the evolution of human consciousness and have kept all of our shows all free, all of the time, for the world to hear. In a recent listener survey, News for the Soul listeners responded with overwhelming appreciation and praise, which they summarized with this one powerful statement. News for the Soul is not just a show. It's a movement. Go to newsforthesoul.com to see for yourself. That's newsforthesoul.com.
We'll be back with more life-changing talk radio in a moment. Did you know that News for the Soul is home to the largest totally free life-changing audio resource on the World Wide Web? And did you know that journalist and single mom Nicole Whitney is single-handedly making this freely available for you to hear? That's why your support is critical to help keep News for the Soul totally free. You can help in several ways. Firstly, you can tell everyone you know about News for the Soul. So many people out there still do not know about this totally free life-changing resource. So do us, yourself, and your friends a favor and pass it on today. Secondly, financial support for News for the Soul helps keep the show going. Whether it's through advertising, donations, or purchases of our exclusive audio and video packages, like the one and only Spoon Bending Kit, which will teach you how to bend metal with your mind for real. This support helps keep us on the air. Go to newsforthesoul.com now to find out more. We invite you to help us help the world, and thanks for tuning in. It's listeners like you who have made News for the Soul the number one life-changing talk radio show in the world, according to Google and AOL. Together, we are already making a difference in our world. So thank you for listening, and thanks in advance for your support. Now, let's get back to the show.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
And we're live again for another couple of hours, News for the Soul. That's what you're tuned into now, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And in our second hour, in the next chunk of airtime here, we have something very special. It's been a long time since I talked to Danny Brinkley, who I call famous dead guy, if you don't know who that is, author of Saved by the Light, Peace in the Light, and all those in the light things, and my co-host for the original 2 years of News for the Soul once it transitioned out of newspaper to radio, Danny Brinkley. He's going to be here live at 7 p.m. Pacific time, God willing. So stick around for that. And right now, someone new to talk to, and we have a bit of a theme. Proof of the Hereafter was how the subject line read in the e-news or email that caught my eye about this, and I've never talked to her before, so this is the first. Carla Wills Brandon. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist, author of 13 books, and she's here to talk about her latest book, Heavenly Hugs, Comfort, Support, and Hope from the Afterlife. So on that note, let's bring her on. Carla, welcome to News for the Soul.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's nice to hear your voice, and it's good to, it's one of my favorite topics, you know, because that's one of the biggest charges around any topic for fear in people is, you know, the afterlife or death or whatever. So where did you get started working on that topic?
Well, my day job is that of a trauma specialist. And how this all started, it started when I was 16 years old, just barely 16. My mother had been very, very sick, and I went to a Sly and the Family Stone concert, and as usual, Sly was late, as was so typical back then, you know, a little chemical here and a chemical there. And so what happened was I suddenly felt very, very ill, and I got up and I walked over toward an ambulance, and I crawled in and I laid down and I went to sleep. And I didn't wake up until the concert was over. And when I went home and went upstairs to my mother's room, what I found out was that at the exact moment that I had crawled into an ambulance, my mother was being loaded into an ambulance and taken to the hospital.
Wow.
Several days after that, I was at home, and suddenly I was awakened at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had this sensation, this knowing that my mother had stopped by to let me know that she was moving on. And I didn't feel frightened at all. As a matter of fact, I got up and I went downstairs and I waited for for someone from the hospital to give me a ring. And eventually somebody did call and they said that yes, indeed, my mother had moved on. Now, at the same time, two other family friends in different locations also awoke at the exact moment of my mother's passing, and they too knew that she had moved on. And just this year I learned that my cousin and my great aunt had also awakened at the exact moment of her crossing over. So that's five of us who all woke up at the same time. Now, of course, in my family it was one of those wonderfully dysfunctional family systems where we didn't talk about what was really going on, and so what I did is I covered up my grief and my loss with a lot of alcohol for about 12 years. Made it through graduate school, made it through college on a scholarship, and when I finally got sober, I decided to revisit my experience with my mother. And by this time, I was working as a trauma specialist, and as a matter of fact, my husband and I were, when the Challenger space shuttle broke up, we basically were called in to do some grief work. So I've been working for a number of decades with all sorts of trauma, PTSD and vets and sexual abuse and domestic violence. But when I got sober, I decided to really take a look at this experience because I thought, wow, that was a really unusual encounter. And so I would bring it up to some of my peers. At that time, I also had begun writing books on addiction and trauma. And the feedback I would get was, oh, you were stressed, and oh, you have an overactive imagination. And so I thought, well, I don't think so. It sure seemed real. Well, I happened to be doing a workshop in England. And so when I'm in England, I love going to old bookstores. So I went to one of those bookstores where you climb down the stairs underneath the street. And I found a book by a physicist named Sir William Barrett that was published in 1926. He and his wife had collected a number of departing visions. She was a gynecological surgeon. And so when I started reading this little book, I was absolutely floored that here were examples of experiences that I had encountered. Not only the experience of feeling my mother basically begin to die when I crawled into an ambulance and she was taken off to the hospital in an ambulance, but also encounters that individuals have in dream time. Also, I learned that the dying can have some of these experiences where they're visited by deceased relatives and friends who come to basically comfort them and let them know death is nothing to fear and to take them to the next dimension. So with Ernest, I started really collecting some of these accounts, and it changed how I did grief work. My clients would say things to me like, I have a job, I have all my teeth, I'm a tax-paying citizen, but I want to share something with you that seems that I don't share with many people. And by opening up myself, I was able to hear my clients, and also I began hearing from the dying. The dying would share with me what they were seeing. And then I would also hear from individuals who had just lost someone, what they had witnessed with their loved one who was getting ready to pass. Or they would tell me about how they would be visited. They were visited while maybe asleep, and then they wake up, and then standing at the foot of the bed was a loved one who's supposed to be at their house or at a hospital. And this loved one is standing at the foot of their bed and saying, I love you, I care about you, and don't worry about me. So in collecting these accounts, I also came across the research of two psychologists from Iceland. And one of them I'm in touch with, and he's just a sweetie. And it was Carlos Osis and Erlinder Haraldsson. And these two guys, very bravely, they took off where Barrett left off. And what they did is they did a longitudinal study. And what they did is they looked at medical people, and then they asked these medical people, doctors and nurses, to fill out forms which had questions on them pertaining to, did you see something unusual when you were working with patients who are getting ready to pass? And what they discovered was that in India and in the United States, there were some consistent themes in watching these patients pass. And what they discovered was that these experiences were, for the most part, 99% of the time, very, very comforting. That if a patient was very combative and frightened of dying, because we live in this horribly death-phobic society, and don't get me started on how age-phobic it is, but we used to die several centuries ago, even a century ago, when we were getting ready to pass. We did so in our own bed, and we did so with our loved ones standing around us, and we did so with our favorite pet at the foot of the bed. And if departing visions occurred, this was seen as something normal. Children were at the bedside of individuals who are getting ready to pass. This was part of the landscape. Death was not seen as something to hide from. And because it wasn't seen as something to hide from, it was normalized. And so when departing visions were shared, those at the bedside would say something to the effect of, oh, you're talking to Grandpa, does he have a message to me, or tell Mom hi, or so there was a continuum. Life and death were seen as, death wasn't seen as the end, it was seen as a transition. So in looking at the research of Haraldsson and Osis, what I saw was, wow, this is really, really something. And this is something that people aren't talking about, because in our culture what we tend to do when people get ready to pass is we move them into nursing homes or we move them into hospitals, and oftentimes they will pass by themselves, even with a hospice movement. Though the hospice movement started out as an organization that was there to assist in healthy, dignified passing, oftentimes it becomes very medical. So in looking at what these two psychologists had done, and looking at what I had collected, and looking at Barrett's work, I decided to write my first book, which was called One Last Tug Before I Go. And as a consequence to that book, I received more accounts from around the world, and that was fascinating. I received accounts from South Africa and Italy and, of course, the UK and China. And what I saw was, as Osis and Haraldsson had pointed out, these experiences were comforting for the dying. They were comforting for the families. They happened to people who were religious, and they happened to people who were atheists. They happen to people who were on medication, and they happen to people who weren't on medication. It didn't matter what the illness was that was creating the passing. There was real consistency. And so with that, what I ended up doing is I wrote my second book, which was called A Glimpse of Heaven. And in that book, I also included near-death experiences and after-death communications and precognitions. Now, up until this point, I had been very leery about sharing any of my own experiences. But with A Glimpse of Heaven, I became a little braver. And with the most recent book, Heavenly Hugs, I thought, you know, you're 56 years old, Carla. Come on, get brave here. And so not only did I take a historical look at the departing vision, but I also shared some modern-day accounts, and then I included some of my own accounts. So it's been a very, very interesting journey. Hello?
Hear me, but we're having mic trouble again. Stand by.
Okay.
While I'm fiddling with this again, I'm having quite a day, I'll tell you. I've blown up two microphones today. How many stories have you collected, Carla?
Well, I've collected and reviewed over 2,000. And what I'll talk about a little bit while you're trying to fix your mic, I think there are some environmental things going on with what's happening in the universe right now. So radios are bleeping out and all sorts of things.
Sorry, are you still there, Carla?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm just testing a couple things. Sorry, bear with me. This is literally my second microphone today. Can you hear
me?
Wow. Can you hear me now? I'm guessing you can't hear me. Okay, I'm going to keep fiddling around in the background here, so go ahead and tell us about how many you've collected. What are the most stunning stories, the most life-changing stories?
Okay, I'll just go ahead and rattle on and go ahead and stop me.
Okay.
The thing that's interesting about the departing vision is that one of the questions that Haraldson and Osis asked is they framed the departing vision in terms of a hallucination because that, of course, our medical community has a real hard time with these experiences. Some of the dying have actually said to me that when they have tried to share these experiences with their physicians, typically what happens is the physician will say, well, that's just a byproduct of your medication or it's a byproduct of your illness. And the interesting thing is this. Being a trauma specialist and having worked with all sorts of individuals, people who have thought disorders, mood disorders, everything from extreme manic bipolar disorder to schizophrenia, what you find with somebody who has a let's say I saw 10 people who were having hallucinations in one day, just boom, 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 one after another. What I would see is 10 very different experiences. From person to person, the hallucination would be different, very different. That's not the case with the departing vision. The departing vision is consistent from one person to the next. The dying report seeing deceased loved ones and friends. They will start talking. Okay, so an example would be my mother-in-law, my very rigid mother-in-law who actually her mother died in Auschwitz during the Holocaust.
Mm.
Not only did her mother die during the Holocaust, but her sister was in Auschwitz, her brother-in-law had died during the Holocaust, and her father was in a gulag in Siberia. And so my mother-in-law, she was in the States, but she was a pretty damaged person. And she was here while my father-in-law, who was also lost many relatives during the Holocaust, he had gone back to Europe to locate relatives. First of all, he was in the military, but he went back to locate surviving relatives. So she had lots and lots of grief and lots of history. And as she aged, she became almost more, she became more frightened. So what aging did for her, unfortunately, was inform her that her own physical passing was coming up. And so, as a matter of fact, when I published the first book on the departing vision, she didn't want to have a thing to do with it because she didn't think she was spiritual enough, which was really sad. She was a woman who, she was very feisty. She was a French professor, one of the first women to be the chair of a department. But here she was scared to death of aging and scared to death of death. Well, when her imminent passing approached, she was very combative. And she suddenly had a visit from my father-in-law who had passed, he had passed 5 years before this time. And we were sitting by her bedside, and all of a sudden she started calling out to Malpa, which in Polish means monkey. And so she started talking to Malpa, and she started becoming very animated, and she started saying to him, no, I'm not ready. I am not ready to go. No. And that's something else that's very interesting. Now, the famed near-death experience researcher Peter Fenwick in England also found this in his research, that oftentimes the dying, they will be visited by deceased relatives and loved ones, but they won't be ready to go. So they will say, you know, give me some time, or not yet, not now. So that's what my mother-in-law was doing. She was fighting. She was not, we tend to die the way we live. So she was very controlling. And so we kept saying to her, Mom, you can go. It's okay. We'll be fine. No problem. She was not willing to leave until one day, all of a sudden, we walked in and we found that she had tears in her eyes and she was talking to her mother who had died in Auschwitz. And wow. As a consequence to making that contact, it's like a lifetime of wound and was being healed as she was on the verge of physical death. So for all of these years, since her mother's passing, in such a grotesque manner, she had suffered so terribly, and here she was on the brink of physical death, and finally she was healing. And she softened up very quickly, and she suddenly became very ready to go, and shortly after, as soon as we left, she passed. And oftentimes the dying will do that. They will. I was just talking to somebody yesterday who was talking about how his mother would not pass until he left the room. So, but oftentimes those sorts of things will happen. There's healing in the process of dying. So it's real typical for a departing vision, for individuals who are having departing visions, who are getting ready to pass, to begin talking to somebody invisible in the room. Another thing that they can have is they have what's called the departing vision stare, where maybe they're not capable of communicating verbally. And what they'll do is they'll start tracking something on the ceiling. They'll just start watching it. And they may even look at us. When we talk to them, they engage with us and they look at us, but then they move back to tracking something on the ceiling or in the far distance. Other things that can happen, my friend Margaret LeMay, she's just a real sweetie. She is a hospice worker, spiritual counselor, she's also a very gifted medium, and she talked about how her mother waited until everybody had left the room, and Margaret had actually gone home to take care of her pets, and while she was taking care of her pets, she was visited by her mother, and she knew her mother had passed on. And standing there feeding her pet, she started talking to her mom, and she said, well, it figures you would wait until I was gone. In other instances, there was the healthcare worker who it was time for her to leave. She had finished her shift, and she was preparing to go home, and as she passed the room of a dying man, she noticed that he was in a bit of a distress. So she went in there and she began nurturing him and comforting him, and his adult child walked in. And so together the two of them, they massaged and lotioned the individual and made him more comfortable. And then she went on home. And when she was home, she received a visitation from this man in the form of an apparition. And he basically said to her, thank you so much, not only for being there for me, but also for my adult child. And she then went and made a phone call to the facility, and she found out, yes, indeed, he had moved on. So wow. In that situation, it's like, even in the process of dying, our personality is still there. We still have manners. We still caretake. It's death doesn't eradicate who we are. Some of the most unusual cases involve situations like this. There's a woman named Robin Abrams, and I met Robin after I had published my first book, I think. And what she shared was that she had a father who was in a facility, and all the siblings and everybody would go visit him on a regular basis. And while he was in the facility, her brother was murdered. And the family made a decision to not tell him that this brother had been murdered because they didn't want to upset him. Now, this is a guy who was not watching TV or reading newspapers and as I said, the family was very cautious about sharing with him. And during a visit, the man said, oh, it's so nice to see all of my children here. And then he said, but wait a second, why is he over there? And what the elderly man was talking about was that he knew his son was in the afterlife. And the Barretts also collected some accounts like that, where somebody would be getting ready to pass, and a friend of theirs or a relative would pass, but this would not be shared, but there would be an awareness that the friend or relative had passed. The dying person would have that awareness and see them. So I love using those accounts with skeptics, because skeptics always like to talk about dying brains, and they like to talk about over-medication, and they like to talk about wishful thinking. But, boy, how do you explain an incident like that where a dying person sees a deceased person, but they have not been told that that person passed? So those are some of my favorite accounts.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay, Carla?
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. Well, I'm on microphone number 3 today. How the hell does that even happen? But anyway, that's a whole other show. Thank God. In one day. Anyway. Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, the way people assume we know everything already and shut other people down while they're trying to tell, that just annoys me. But anyway. You know, and I've always been really careful not to shut my kids down. If they're telling me of some account of things, I mean, kids and pets, they're more aware on some levels. You know, one question that comes to mind, and I've had this one asked a lot, is why doesn't everyone get to, you know, have visitations?
We don't know. And you know what? They may be having visitations, and they may not be talking about it, because what I've discovered is that a lot of people just don't talk about it, or maybe they're in a medical situation where they can't talk about it. What's interesting is that oftentimes somebody with Alzheimer's or some sort of neurological difficulty, maybe they've been in a coma for a while. And then suddenly what will happen is they will wake and they will very, with all, they'll be very lucid. And what they will do is they will look at their loved ones who are at the bedside, and then they will look maybe towards the sky. This lawyer friend of mine who asked me to please never give out his identity, and I get that all the time. his father, who was getting ready to pass, he had been in a coma, and suddenly he came to, and he actually sat up in bed and held his arms up. And that is not uncommon. I think that when you have a medical community that has difficulty looking at these experiences or they brush them off so readily, I think that more people are having these encounters. When my grandmother was staring at tracking something on the wall, I didn't know what was going on. All I knew was that she was getting ready to pass, and I was pretty young, and nobody was talking about her passing, and so I didn't know that maybe she was having visitations from my mother and her son who had passed away. So I think that in our consciousness right now, which thankfully is beginning to expand, but in our current consciousness, we have a long way to go with regard to death and dying. As I said before, people do not want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about aging. My son, who, well, he's 18, but when he was 3, I live on an island, and he and I were making a trip off the island to go to a health food store to get some things, because what we have on this island is barbecue fish. And so every once in a while I have to make a trip. And my father-in-law had been very, very sick. And my son started talking about somebody being in the car, and he wanted this person to drive the car because he wanted me to get in the back seat because he wanted a cuddle because he was sleepy. And now the clinician in me thought, wow, the stress is really something. My son is now talking to invisible people, and wow, we got to get some downtime here. So I said to my son, I said, honey, I don't see who it is you're seeing, so I'm not going to let them drive the car. And my son was incensed. And then I said, who is in the back seat with you? And he said, Domus is in the back seat. Let Domus drive. And so I just said no and continued on. And then a couple of days later, we were at our office house, and we had a 100-year-old house that we used as an office for a number of years. And my son and my husband were outside, and they found a possum that had died in the front yard. And so my husband was bagging it up, and my son said, the possum went to the sky. Possum went to the sky, and that's where Da's going. That's what he called his grandfather. And so on Friday the 13th, and this is Thursday the 13th, but on Friday the 13th, we were at a gathering with a friend of ours who is a rabbi, and I said to this friend of mine, I said, you know, Josh has really been talking a lot about somebody named Domus who is around and who is here to take Da to the sky, and I just don't know what to do. The stress is getting to be too much. And so my rabbi friend wrote Domus out in Hebrew and then in Aramaic, and he said, oh, my goodness, that's the angel of death. Where did Josh hear about that? And then that night, my father-in-law died peacefully in my husband's arms after the 10 o'clock news, of course, on a Friday the 13th, which fits him so well. So this is the anniversary of my father-in-law's passing today, as we have, as I am on this show with you. So, and I can just feel my father-in-law grinning from ear to ear, because that was the type of individual he was. So, but if I had shared that with the medical staff, if I had talked about that with the medical staff, as a matter of fact, one of the hospice workers, we had to move one of the hospice workers out of the room because she just couldn't handle the passing. The physician who was in charge of my father at that time would talk over him. And my father-in-law was a surgeon. And my father-in-law would become very aggravated because he knew he was dying. So, of course, we weren't going to talk about these sorts. We, as a family, weren't going to talk about these sorts of things. Now, there are a few physicians around who are very open-minded and who will say things like, I have heard stories just like what you're sharing. Or, you know, I don't know that much about it, but let me find somebody who can help and who can give you some information. And if physicians would just be willing to say that to the dying or their family members, as opposed to saying to family members, we need to give your loved one some Vicodin or hydrocodone, because having the, saying those sorts of things, that's, they're in a lot, that's real, that's an expression of some real difficulty, and that's a hallucination. I'm just so grateful that we had some awareness in our family so that I could finally say to Josh, wow, Josh, Domus came and took Da to the sky? That's really great. Is Domus still around? And, of course, my son said no, because once my father-in-law passed, Domus had moved on too. But, unfortunately, in our culture, even in our religious traditions, even clergy can be difficult to deal with. Even clergy can say things like, oh, that's the devil's work, or you're just some new age wacko. As a matter of fact, in one newspaper when the first book came out, that's actually how they portrayed me, as some new age wacko. I was incensed. I couldn't believe it, because it really diminished the work that I had done on the departing vision. And I was, and as a matter of fact, when this, with the last two books, I have not let this particular newspaper know, because I just don't want to deal with this. So,
wow.
And then, of course, I have to talk about my own field, which they're the worst. A lot of people who are in the mental health field, when they hear these accounts, they refer immediately to a psychiatrist for medication, as opposed to seeing it as something healthy and processing it and using it as a part of the grief experience. So if somebody comes to my office and they start talking about a departing vision, what I do is I say, oh, my goodness, I'm so glad you had that experience. Look, here are some accounts that maybe you can relate to. And the look on their faces, the look of absolute relief, is amazing. It doesn't get rid of grief. I will say that. What it does is it softens grief, because we still, for those of us who believe in an afterlife, we still have the same worries. We still worry about our loved ones. Are they, yes, they're in the afterlife, but what are they doing? Are they okay? And we still miss them in skin, as my oldest son used to say. And so, because it's a relationship, so the relationship changes, so that's what we grieve. We grieve the change in the relationship, and we have to come up with new ways to communicate or learn to communicate with our loved ones on the other side. So my job, what I'm dedicated to, I'm kind of a small fish. That's sort of how I see myself in this whole scheme of things. But my job is to just provide the information to the people who want it, and to be there to support the people who have had these experiences, to let them know that they're not alone, and then to direct them toward resources where they can find more like-minded people and learn that actually witnessing a departing vision is a gift. And I just try to keep it that simple.
So, you know, what is, with your extensive research in this area, what is your perspective on the reality of, well, just what reality really is?
Well, that's an interesting question. I do believe that somebody is there to greet us when we do pass. I believe that every single person will be greeted, that we do not pass by ourselves. And I also believe that what happens is that those that are there to greet us take us to the other side. You know, when somebody has a near-death experience, that's a departing vision. It's just that with a near-death experience, they come back. So when somebody has a departing vision, I suspect that what they do is they go to a different dimension, that they have the experience that the near-death experiencer has, that they are greeted by an even larger group of deceased loved ones, guides, who have been there helping them out, and that there is another reality. I mean, the journey continues. Now, what exactly happens in that other reality, I'm not real sure. I have some personal ideas. I think the whole field of quantum physics and non-local consciousness has really opened the door for a lot of us to take a look at some of this stuff and go, wow, through the wormhole we go. We shed the physical body and then we move on. But as far, I think that we're just at the very tip of the iceberg in looking at some of this stuff. You know, you have even Alexander, who put out his book on his near-death experience, and the thing that I love the most about that is there's nothing like having a really, really kind of brilliant neurosurgeon sitting there with his own brain scans explaining how his brain was really, really dead while he had this fantastic near-death experience where he went to the other side and he was guided by a sister that he never met because he was adopted. So I think that when people share these accounts, when they bravely share these accounts, and don't get me wrong, because I've had my share of many ridicule from skeptics who have set me up to be some sort of quack. And with the first book, I was totally unprepared for it because I had written books on, as I said, trauma and addiction and boundaries and sexual abuse. And that was such a different arena. And to find myself on shows, I would go on traditional shows, and I would find myself being almost ridiculed for what I, blind and dumb, going, wanting to just share some experience, strength, and hope, and then getting plummeted. So now I'm a little more thick-skinned. It doesn't really faze me as much as it did the first go-round and second go-round. But my point being that I think that, yes, there is a different reality that that will in time be defined, and that when we do reach that place, I think what's going to happen is we're all going to be like the person who has the near-death experience or who witnesses the deathbed vision. In that if I'm not worrying about death and dying and I'm not worrying about aging, what I can do is I can live life. It frees me up. And then I can be more hooked into my own creativity and I can be more of a humanitarian. And I won't, it'll change my perspective about who I am and what my place is in this universe and what it is, what my mission is here. And my husband had a near-death experience, and I said to him, what was I saying? He turned 60, so I was talking to him about something, and he said, well, I'm not going anywhere. My mission isn't complete. And I went, oh, okay. That's good to know. So, but we all have a purpose for being here. So
that leads me to the big question of the hour, which is really, I mean, there's, you know, people listening that have a riveting fear, paralyzing fear of death and aging, I guess. More death probably than aging, but both, they're out there. You know, and how do you really absorb this information so it's not just sort of intellectual, but where you can really get a solid faith-based settling feeling around that topic?
Well, one of the first things to do is just some simple meditation. And that meditation can involve a candle and sitting with a candle and just learning how to quiet the mind. You know, and set an egg timer for 5 minutes. Just light a candle, sit at a table, let your mind just chatter away, chatter, 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 and look at the flame. And then when you get to a place where your mind has begun to settle down a little bit, go find a full-length mirror and sit in front of that mirror, preferably with your back against a white wall. And just look into that mirror at yourself and begin to see that there is a field of energy around you. And what you'll first see is you'll see a white light, sort of a white boundary around you. And then you'll begin to see maybe a few colors, like yellow is usually the next one that's pretty common. And then if there's some anger, sometimes red will pop up. But what that does is that begins to show us that we're much more than our physical body. When we can see the energy around our bodies, outside of our bodies, that's a good place to start, because that just reaffirms that, wow, there's so much more here. Then the next thing I would do is there are lots and lots of near-death experience accounts on lying on YouTube. And just go ahead and start watching those. And what begins to happen is that there's this sense of, there's a feeling that there's a resonation with that. So a lot of these individuals talk about going home. They talk about how they're ready to go home, or this was their real home. And in watching these videos, just notice how you feel. Do you feel scared, or do you feel sad, or do you feel comforted? But it really is about beginning to get in touch with the energy that expands outside our bodies and also with our emotional self. And then the third thing, these are all very beginning easy things to do. Think of somebody that you lost. Somebody that you really, really love dearly. And before you go to bed at night, have a picture of them by your bedside and look at their picture. And then ask them to come to you in your dreams. And then have a pen and a pad next to your bed so that you can start documenting your dreams. And eventually what will happen is that chances are you'll have some sort of visitation. And then what you do is you notice how different these sorts of dreams are from regular dreams. Regular dreams help relieve us of our stress. Most of these dreams are in black and white. A lot of us don't remember these dreams. These dreams keep us healthy. If we're a trauma survivor, our history comes up in these dreams. But when we have dreams about deceased loved ones that we care about and are close to, what happens is that they typically are in color, and they feel very, very real, and they stay with us for the rest of our lives. So those are just some very beginning things that we can start to do.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. Let's talk about how people can get your book or books up.
Well, there are several things that they can do. They can go to Amazon.com and just search my name, Carla Wills Brandon. Or what they can do is they can go to my webpage, which is at www.carlawillsbrandon.com. They can also go to YouTube and just search Deathbed Visions or Departing Visions, and I have a series of 3 to 4 minute clips that talk some more about the departing vision. And they can also go to Carla Wills Brandon Author Digs page on Facebook, and what I do there is I load up, interesting afterlife videos and research and information that radio shows that maybe I'm doing or other people that are like-minded like myself are doing, and just begin to be a gatherer. That's what I call it. It's the gathering stage. It's about recognizing I have a fear of aging because I have a fear of death. And because I know this about myself, I'm going to take some action and I'm going to do something about it, and I'm going to start gathering information. So those are some places where people can go.
Well, I think the work you're doing is really important. It's one of the biggest, you know, fears that people face. And one of my favorite topics, of course, I actually got so excited about this topic that it's still on my to-do list to have a separate radio show where it's just experiencer after experiencer and nothing but just, you know, we're the same thing where you just gather stories and build to the point where you know there's something more. There's something beyond.
I think that'd
beyond.
Be a great idea. Oh,
wouldn't
I think
it?
That'd be wonderful, yeah.
Hmm. Near Death Radio, I know I had started launching it and then life happened. So it's on the list, but you know what? As soon as I do launch it, you'll be back.
Well, one of the things that's really important also to know is that the generations coming at my children's generations, and one son is 26 and one is, as I said, 18, and even the kind of like hitting 40 crowd, the 30-year-olds, and definitely the 20-year-olds, there are so many in that generation, the pressure on them to be perfect, to stay youthful forever, to be a certain way. Spirituality is unfortunately going by the wayside. Every once in a while, some young person crops up and they're really searching and into spirituality, and I just push them and say, go save your generation. But I think that for those that are listening to your show and shows like this, it's essential for us to get our own selves straight with regard to this topic, because there are so many people out there who are coming up behind us who they don't have a clue. And maybe right now in the throes of youth, they're okay. I have people who come into my office who are in their mid-20s who are having breast implants, and they're having, oh, my goodness sakes, late mid-30s, they're having facelifts. And it's just
gone.
The pressure that I see is amazing. And so for these individuals, if we can be clear, then we'll be in a better position to be there for these young people who are coming up behind us. And I have to say, you know, my generation, we're a bunch of hippies. We all did a lot of drugs. We all tried to expand our mind. And so, you know, some of us got the whole spiritual thing. Some of us went the materialistic way. But enough of us have some of this spirituality that we can be there. And then some of the folks behind me a decade or so, I'm watching them, and I'm watching them share their spirituality and share their journey into exploring afterlife and precognition and remote viewing and all of those wonderful things that are out there. But then after that, very, very few people. I mean, that's – and so we really – those of us who are on this path, we really – we have an obligation.
Well, your books are out there, and we've got you on our homepage on newsforthesoul.com, so people can find you there. And I really appreciate you having the time to spend some time with me today.
Well, thanks, Nicole. I kind of wonder about the whole 12-12-12 thing and your microphones there.
I know. Three microphones. I'm on my last – actually, I've been multitasking for the last 20 minutes. I've just purchased a whole bunch of microphones on eBay. Apparently, I need to stock up. What the hell is that all about? But anyway, yeah, it's just the
some
energy.
Some sort of energy burst or something. Yeah, something's,
yeah.
Something's going on for you there, girl. I don't know. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's all good, and thanks so much, Carla. That was fun.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure, and keep in touch, okay?
Thank you.
Carla Wills-Brandon, and next up, Danion Brinkley. Speaking of near-death experiences, we go right into, I call him epic NDE-er. And famous dead guy, Danion Brinkley, right after this. We're going to take a little break and get everything queued up. I'm actually going to see if I can dial out on this board. I haven't done that before, and you know, the way it's been going with blowing stuff up, we'll just hang in there. God willing, I should be back in about 3 minutes' time with Danion Brinkley.
For years, News for the Soul listeners have had a direct experience with their power to create their reality through our exclusive Spoon Bending Kit, a mind-over-matter training
that teaches you how to bend metal with your mind for real. Well, what if you can use that same technology on your finances? What if you can take your same intention power and use it on the so-called recession? Well, you can. News for the Soul has just announced the release of its newest life-changing kit, the Prosperity Kit. We have combined the intention technology of our spoon bending kits with a decade of research to create a program that has the power to change your financial life. Isn't it time to transcend fear and live the way we intended? For real? Go now to newsforthesoul.com and click on the Prosperity Kit banner. That's newsforthesoul.com.
How would you like to learn how to bend metal with your mind for real? Well, you can. News for the Soul is home to the one and only Spoon Bending Kit, an instantly downloadable digital gift that contains 2 hours of audio and visual instructions designed to get your mind out of the way and teach you how to truly affect solid matter just with your thoughts. Find out once and for all how you are affecting your reality with every thought you think. Don't let anything block you from creating the life that you want. Download the newsforthesoul.com spoon bending kit today. Just go to newsforthesoul.com right now and click on the bent spoon. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Would you like to make your special event even more special? Shimmy for the Soul Belly Dancers will make it divine. Launched by News for the Soul's producer and host, Nicole Whitney, in May 2009, Shimmy for the Soul is one of the busiest troupes in Vancouver, B.C. They're diverse, deeply connected to the spirit of the dance, and available for special events of any size. Visit shimmyforthesoul.com to find out more. That's shimmyforthesoul.com.
We'll be back with more life-changing talk radio in a moment. Did you know that News for the Soul is home to the largest totally free life-changing audio resource on the World Wide Web? And did you know that journalist and single mom Nicole Whitney is single-handedly making this freely available for you to hear? That's why your support is critical to help keep News for the Soul totally free. You can help in several ways. Firstly, you can tell everyone you know about News for the Soul. So many people out there still do not know about this totally free life-changing resource. So do us, yourself, and your friends a favor and pass it on today. Secondly, financial support for News for the Soul helps keep the show going. Whether it's through advertising, donations, or purchases of our exclusive audio and video packages, like the one and only Spoon Bending Kit, which will teach you how to bend metal with your mind for real. This support helps keep us on the air. Go to newsforthesoul.com now to find out more. We invite you to help us help the world. And thanks for tuning in. It's listeners like you who have made News for the Soul the number one life-changing talk radio show in the world, according to Google and AOL. Together, we are already making a difference in our world. So thank you for listening, and thanks in advance for your support. Now, let's get back to the show.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Okay, we're back, and I'm really excited because it worked. Woo, I didn't even know I could do that, calling out on the board. All right, I'm Nicole Marie Whitney, still, and this still is News. There goes my voice. News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And in the early days, I used to say that along with my fantabulous co-host back then. I used to call him famous dead guy Daniel Brinkley. Epic NDE-er and total awesome guy, author of Saved by the Light, At Peace in the Light, and lots of other things by now, I would imagine. It's time to get caught up with the world of Daniel Brinkley. And I believe I've got him. Hang on. Or it's going. There we go. Daniel, how are you?
I am great, Nicole. How are you?
I am also great, and I've been missing you. It's so good to hear your voice.
You too, and happy holidays.
Happy 12-12-12. It seems kind of fitting that we talk now. Oh, did I lose you? Are you there?
No, I'm here. I was just enjoying hearing your voice, Nicole.
So tell me what you've been doing for the 12-12-12 event, if anything.
Well, what I've been doing is going through all those things like most of us should go through, that cleansing, that clearing, that paying attention to not what you eat but why you're eating it, looking at how am I going to begin the next 5,125 years, and paying attention to the